At which point my dear mother taught me to swear properly.
Unspeakables with me, Phil Wang.
And me, Susie Dent. The word is wangy.
Yes, I've always thought the definition of wangy was intelligent and suave.
Next Thursday night, 6:30 comedy on BBC Sounds and Radio 4.
Good morning. It is 6 o'clock on Thursday, the 24th of October. Good to be with you and have your company today. This is Today with Amol Rajan and Emma Barnett.
The headlines this morning: Commonwealth leaders are to defy the UK by raising the issue of reparations for historic slavery at their summit in Samoa. Disposable vapes are to be banned in England from next summer.
Also in today's programme, the thick of it and Veep creator Armando Iannucci on a new generation of political buzzwords and what he makes of the presidential race.
Now Sleepy Joe would say the unemployment rate in the great state of Ohio. No, you're in South Carolina.
Well, I'd say it didn't last very long because Flashman is back.
Perhaps Captain Hindsight would like to tell us.
And...
Well, it's 1341 BC, and we're over here in ancient Egypt, where a wickle baby has just been born. And his name is Tutankhamun, though he's also known as Tutankhamen, Tutankhamon, Tutankhaten, Amun-Tut, Ankh-Steve, and King Tut, though probably not Steve.
No, not Steve. A special award for the team behind Horrible Histories. I was watching it last night with my son. What makes the show so magical for children and adults? The BBC News is read by Chris Aldridge.
The BBC has learned that Commonwealth leaders are preparing to defy the UK at their summit in Samoa by agreeing to examine ways of securing reparatory justice for the transatlantic slave trade. That could include payments and an official apology. Yesterday, the Prime Minister said that while there was no question slavery was abhorrent, he wanted the meeting on the Pacific Island to focus on the here and now. Our diplomatic correspondent James Landale has this exclusive report.
Keir Starmer wants the Commonwealth Summit to discuss existing challenges such as economic growth and climate change. But Caribbean leaders want to begin a debate about securing reparations for historic slavery, much of which involved Britain. And it looks like they may get it. I've been told the draft summit communique says the time has come for a meaningful, truthful and respectful conversation about reparatory justice for what it calls the transatlantic trade in enslaved Africans. It also says Commonwealth leaders will agree to prioritise and facilitate further and additional research into the issue. A UK government spokesman said reparations were not on the agenda and would not be paid. The Prime Minister told reporters he did not want endless discussions about reparations. But diplomats said the clock was now ticking on a debate that potentially could one day cost Britain billions of pounds.
Single-use vapes are to be banned in England from next summer. Ministers say they want to end a throwaway culture and protect people's health. Here's our political correspondent, Damian Grammaticus.
Almost 10% of people in the UK, including a quarter of children aged 11 to 15, are thought to use vapes. They throw away nearly 5 million of the disposable plastic devices each week, often as litter. Powered by lithium batteries, which can easily ignite, the vapes can't be refilled and are difficult to recycle. Many end up in landfill or are incinerated. A ban was announced in January by Rishi Sunak when he was Prime Minister, but not enacted before the election. The government says sales in England will be illegal from the 1st of June and is hoping to align that with Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, which are already moving ahead with bans of their own.
The public spending watchdog says the system supporting children and young people with special educational needs in England is in need of urgent reform. The National Audit Office says the current arrangement is financially unsustainable and is letting down families. The government says it's determined to rebuild confidence in the system. Here's our education editor, Branwyn Jeffries.
The National Audit Office describes a system where costs are spiralling without making the lives of children and young people significantly better. To meet their legal obligations, councils have spent more, accumulating large deficits. Growing numbers of parents have applied for legally binding education, health and care plans, resulting in a third less being spent on each child with a plan. The Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, says it will take time to turn the system around.
Turkey says its military has struck sites in Iraq and Syria linked to the Kurdish group, the PKK, after blaming it for an attack on a state-owned defence company near Ankara that killed at least five people. Turkish defence officials said 32 targets had been destroyed. Police have arrested a 60-year-old woman on suspicion of manslaughter following the deaths of three people at a care home in Dorset. Officers say the deaths are being treated as unexplained, but that carbon monoxide poisoning is their main line of inquiry. Louisa Pilbeam reports.
Emergency services were called to the Gainsborough care home in Swanage yesterday morning, where they found three residents had died. Seven other people were taken to hospital and the home was evacuated with around 40 residents, some of whom have dementia and complex needs, being taken to a nearby church. Dorset police said a 60-year-old local woman has been arrested and they would be investigating whether there had been any actions or omissions that were grossly negligent.
Another attempt to create an independent regulator for elite men's football is being made, with ministers saying they've strengthened previous plans. The Premier League says it remains concerned about what it calls the unprecedented powers to intervene in the game. Here's our sports editor, Dan Rowan.
Initially tabled in March, the Football Governance Bill failed to pass through Parliament before the general election. Today the government will reintroduce it, but with beefed-up powers for the independent regulator it will create. It will mean clubs must engage with fans on issues such as changes to ticket prices and improve their record on equality and diversity. The regulator will also have the power to redistribute the tens of millions of pounds that the Premier League gives to relegated clubs to teams lower down the football pyramid.
Research suggests climate change is putting polar bears at a higher risk of contracting viruses, bacteria and parasites than they were 30 years ago. In a study published in the journal PLOS One, scientists examined recent blood samples collected from wild polar bears and compared them with samples from the 1980s and 90s. Our science correspondent Victoria Gill has more details.
As the Arctic ice melts because of climate change, polar bears are spending more time on land. And scientists from the US Geological Survey wanted to understand how this affected the predators' risk of contracting certain parasites, viruses, and bacteria that are mainly associated with land-based animals. They compared recent blood samples from polar bears in the Chukchi Sea between Alaska and Russia with those collected 30 years ago in the same area. Five of the six different viruses, bacteria and parasites that they tested for were more common in the recently collected samples.
Victoria Gill reporting.
Chris, thank you very much indeed. It is 7 minutes past six and time to say good morning to Sarah Keith-Lucas, who's got the weather. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, good morning to you, Amol. We've got a mostly dry, fine day ahead today. Southerly winds, and they're quite brisk winds as well, so it is going to feel mild and breezy with the best of the sunshine towards the east. So for southeast England, through the Midlands, eastern England and northeast England, there's a few mist and fog patches around this morning, not as many as there were yesterday. They'll lift and clear fairly quickly and then some long spells of sunshine, just a little bit more cloud developing into the afternoon, but a fine day ahead, 16 to 18 degrees, so still quite mild here. Further west, so we're looking at southwest England through Wales, northwest England, all of Scotland and Northern Ireland. Most places are looking dry. We have got quite a lot of cloud around and it could be thick enough for the odd little bit of light rain or drizzle, especially around coasts and hills in the west. The Western Isles in the northwest of Scotland will see some more persistent rain here, but most other places will see sunshine developing into the afternoon as those southerly winds break up the cloud. Top temperatures around about 14 to 18 degrees here, and then overnight tonight some showery rain moves into the southwest of the UK. Should be cloudy and dry though elsewhere.
Thanks for that, Sarah. It's 8 minutes past six. Let's have a look at those morning papers and headlines. And with the budget now less than 2 weeks away, the Times reports that the Chancellor has gone to the International Monetary Fund annual meeting in Washington in an attempt to convince global finance chiefs that she will restore stability. We'll have more on that later in the programme. And according to The Guardian, Rachel Reeves will announce that she hopes to unlock an extra £50 billion by changing the UK's fiscal rules. Sources say that energy and transport projects will be a particular focus of the new funding, but the paper says the Treasury has hinted that it won't initially take advantage of the extra scope.
Several of the papers also offer more predictions about what might be in that budget. Fury over Reeves' raid on private sector pensions is the headline in the Daily Mail, which reports that the Chancellor could impose national insurance on employers' pension contributions. In its leader column, The Sun describes the plans as damaging and divisive. Separately, The Eye newspaper reports that the Ministry of Justice budget is feared to be on the chopping block, prompting warnings from Conservatives that such a move would be a disaster for victims of crime.
New proposals to ban disposable vapes from next June are described in The Sun as nanny state meddling. The paper offers two opposing views on the crackdown, with one writer describing it as disastrous and short-sighted, while another says it's good for parents' peace of mind.
A number of the front pages report on what the Daily Star labels the American war of interference. Get it? Interference. The Daily Mirror says Donald Trump's claims that the Labour Party is interfering in the presidential election are ludicrous. Party officials have been backed by the former Conservative Justice Secretary Sir Robert Buckland, who tells The Guardian they did nothing wrong when they travelled to the US to campaign for Kamala Harris. In the Daily Telegraph, government insiders say the row is unhelpful for the relationship between the UK and the US, but The Times quotes a British diplomatic source as saying that this is what life with Trump will be like, so ministers better get used to it.
Dame Esther Ranson responds in the Daily Express to reports that the Health Secretary will vote against proposals to change assisted dying laws. Wes Streeting is said to be opposed to the measures because he does not believe that the palliative care system can support them. But Dame Esther, who has lung cancer and long campaigned for a change in the law, writes that she is deeply distressed by his position, and she asks, "What kind of health minister are you if you have no respect or understanding for the views of terminally ill patients?"
Government officials tell the Financial Times that civil servants have been informed they must spend at least 60% of their working hours in the office. The paper says, or points out, that the home working hopes have been dashed for some civil servants, but officials insist the move is about being pragmatic.
And the Times carries a report which has made me feel all strange this morning. A study has suggested that the origins of kissing might not be as romantic as previously thought. It says experts believe it was one way our evolutionary ancestors, the great apes, groomed one another, using their lips to remove ticks and lice from fur. That has put a whole new spin on kissing for me. Certainly, I've kissing my children. I haven't thought about it from that point of view, Amal.
But that's not kissing, is it? That's removing lice and fur. That's
well, it depends on your technique,
well,
maybe.
Well. I think we should move on. It's 11 minutes past six, and let's talk to Will Vernon, because there's this alarming story from Swanage in Dorset, where a 60-year-old woman has been arrested on suspicion of manslaughter after three people died at a care home. And Will Vernon joins us now. Will, morning. What more do we know about what actually happened?
Yeah, good morning, Amal. I'm outside the Gainsborough care home. There's still a police presence here, and that's because the investigation is ongoing. Police said last night that an arrest was made by detectives investigating the deaths of three people here. A 60-year-old local woman has been arrested on suspicion of manslaughter. She remains in police custody, and officers are looking into possible actions of gross negligence. These deaths are being treated as unexplained, but carbon monoxide poisoning is the main line of inquiry, although police say there's no risk to the wider public. The local gas distribution company was here yesterday, also checking this site after that incident. The health and safety executive also looking into it. So gas does appear to be the most likely cause of the deaths of those three people. This is a sleepy seaside town, you know, a close-knit community. Most people had never heard so many sirens when early yesterday morning an enormous emergency response was launched, police, fire, multiple ambulances sent to the scene, and the 40 or so residents from this care home who were evacuated safely, they were sent to the local church hall, but they were then moved to other homes in the area until it's safe to come back here to the Gainsborough care home and once the police have finished their investigation.
Will Vernon, in Dorset and outside that care home, as you say. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
13 minutes past six. Let's cross the pond to the story around the businessman Elon Musk, ranked by Forbes as the world's richest person, who may be breaking election law by giving away $1 million each day until America goes to the polls to someone who signs his online petition in favour of free speech and the right to bear arms. Now, the issue comes over Musk only making that lottery available to registered voters. And in the US, it is illegal to pay someone to register to vote. I spoke to our BBC North America correspondent David Willis about this earlier this morning.
A key condition of entering the contest is that participants are registered to vote in one of the seven key battleground states, those states that will decide the outcome of this election. And Mr. Musk has already presented million-dollar checks to three voters in Pennsylvania, one in North Carolina. He is, of course, a staunch supporter of Donald Trump, and he's been actively trying to register conservative voters in the swing states even before he came up with this particular plan. Critics of this sort of daily giveaway, if you like, say that it violates federal laws forbidding the payment of money to voters. Elon Musk says, for his part, that it's open to supporters of any political party. And now the US Justice Department is alleged to have become involved.
So is there a legal risk in terms of Elon Musk doing this?
It's a good question. If this does amount to a payment to induce people to register to vote, then the thinking goes that it is in violation of the law. If, as Elon Musk's people would argue, it's simply a payment to induce people to sign a petition, then it's not. And I think all of this begets two key questions, Emma. Is the Justice Department, having warned the Political Action Committee founded by Elon Musk that it could be in violation of the law, prepared to take action to either stop the lottery or fine Elon Musk before the election takes place? And why, given that around, 80% of voters in Pennsylvania, for example, have already registered to vote, is Elon Musk doing this? I think the answer to the first question is unlikely. The view of many legal analysts here is that such a case would be pretty difficult to win. The answer to the second question is that with the election still so close, any information about unregistered voters is probably going to be valuable because it could be used to persuade them to get unvote.
David, thank you very much.
Yeah, really interesting about Elon Musk. And we've got this week's episode of the Today podcast, which will be live for you very shortly on BBC Sounds. We look in detail at Musk's involvement in politics. We talk to the New York Times journalist Ryan Mack, who's been following him closely, not least about what he's done to the platform previously known as Twitter. But now at 16 minutes past six, we say good morning to a real person, not a disembodied voice from Salford.
Live
and in front of us in the studio, it is the great Will Bain with the business news. Good to see you, Will.
Morning, Amol. Yeah, we're going to be talking to Elon Musk as well, because some really interesting results out from Tesla, of course, his electric car company, overnight. Really strong results and what might be ahead. But before that, I've been speaking to the chief executive of the UK's biggest pub group, and he's warning of widespread closures if there's no help on business rates in next week's budget. David McDowell runs Stonegate. It operates 4,500 pubs across the UK, including big chains like Yates's, Walkabout, Be It One, and the Slug Lettuce brands. Like many in his industry, he's particularly worried about what will happen to business rates next April. Currently, businesses in England get 75% off their rates bills, up to £110,000. In Wales, it's 40%. No relief schemes currently exist in mainland Scotland or Northern Ireland. But before we got onto rates, I asked David McDowell if he was bracing himself for the budget.
I think the hospitality sector and the pub sector is bracing to an extent. I think the business community is bracing. But what we hope is that the Chancellor recognises the critical and vital role that pubs and the wider hospitality industry play in communities up and down the country.
Bracing for what in particular?
Well, above all, I'm really hoping to see a reform of business rates. That was promised in the Labour manifesto. And ideally, we need a new, lower, permanent and universal business rates multiplier. And that would bring much needed certainty. That would in turn help spur investment, and it would support job opportunities up and down the country. And as it stands, there is business rates relief in place for small businesses, and that stops completely in April. And for a sector that's faced a continual barrage of challenges from the pandemic to the inflationary environment to the continued cost of living challenges that we face, then the complete removal of that rate relief would prove very, very costly for pubs bars, restaurants and cafes up and down the length and breadth of the UK.
Just spell that out for listeners, David, if you can. Have you quantified it? How much are you talking about?
For someone running their local pub, there are a couple of stats that I think are important. And these days, they probably make around about 12 pence of profit for every pint of beer that they sell. And the removal of that business rates relief means that for small publicans, it's likely that in many cases, their business rates bill will quadruple from April. And with the complete burden of the cost, inflation and regulatory pressure that they're facing at the moment, they don't have any more to give.
It's been spelt out, hasn't it, for months as well, though, the kind of fiscal predicament the public finances are in at the moment, and that there are going to have to be, you know, difficult decisions if we want public services to continue working, etc., things like that in this country. Do you accept that there are going to be difficult things here within this budget, and that business is going to be part of the people who are going to have to shoulder some of that?
We absolutely accept that, but this government was elected on a growth agenda, and we need to see that rhetoric turn to reality. And the Chancellor has often talked about the importance, quite rightly, of the local pub as the real beating heart of local communities up and down the country. So we just want anything that happens to be fair, proportionate, respectful of that, and also to address some of the significant issues that we have talked about for quite some time. First and foremost, that cliff edge that the sector and small business owners up and down the country feel is around the corner on business rates.
It seems frustrating, the whole thing.
It is frustrating, and I think that, you know, the sector continues to serve those high streets and those communities in a really meaningful way. Post-COVID, everyone really recognised the important connection they have with their local pub. And this is just about us being able to continue to support publicans up and down the country to be able to do that.
We've had a couple of guests on the programme, signature groups, big Scottish pub groups, saying it borders on the pointless sometimes.
I empathise with that statement. And if you look at the complete and total regulatory burden and the complete and total cost burden that some of these pubs have faced over the last 4 or 5 years, then publicans up and down the country are probably thinking that at times there is not much more left to give. The government has to recognise that and has to give them an environment where they can continue to thrive and support these local communities.
Away from pure policy that we've talked a lot about in detail, David, I just wondered about, or for want of a better phrase, about vibes, I suppose. We've talked about it quite a bit on our programme. You know, the very negative statements, you know, the doom and gloom, I suppose, that the government has laid out, what they would call the very difficult financial situation that the country faces. Has that dampened demand?
The broader impact on consumer sentiment of the rhetoric that we've heard over the last month or so is not particularly positive. We're fortunate in the pub sector that people have that meaningful connection to their local pub or their local boozer, and they don't really, in the main, see going for a pint on Tuesday night to watch the football as a massive luxury. Mm. It certainly doesn't help us when the general sentiment is not a positive one.
David McDowell, Chief Executive of the Stonegate Group, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Anna McDonald is with us. Anna's the investment manager at Aubrey Capital Management to pick through what's moving the stock markets this morning. Anna, morning.
Good morning.
Big news from Boeing in what, the last couple of hours, their machinists working for them have rejected this new pay offer, so this strike carries on.
Absolutely. They were offered a 35% wage hike. They were going for 40%, but what they voted against primarily seems to be that Boeing have not relented on continuing their defined benefit pension plan. So the strike is set to continue, which is more bad news for Boeing.
Yeah, the vote a little bit, it was about 90% the first round of the vote to go on strike, wasn't it? 60-odd% voting to reject the offer this time. Came a day, Anna, though, as well, after they released their financial results with, perhaps unsurprising, but an enormous quarterly loss.
Yes, this strike, which is happening at their Seattle-based plants, is costing them $100 million a day. So the cash burn is really significant. They've signalled a further $4 billion cash burn for the rest of the year. So, yes, this is getting to a pretty severe situation for Boeing.
Closer to home, we heard a bit of concern, I guess, for the economic conditions from Stonegate there. A bit more upbeat from Lloyds Banking Group in their financial results.
Yes, they beat expectations in the third quarter, and they talked about the impairment charge for customers that fears could default, and that is still pretty benign, as the chief financial officer put it. They talked about mortgage applications jumping with a very competitive market still, but their loan book is growing a little bit. So that was pretty good, and they've got a very resilient capital position. So from an investor's point of view, perhaps we could look forward to further dividend payments in the future.
And from a global markets perspective, the story really overnight was Tesla. Shares up as much as 12% on some pretty positive results, not just in the now, but looking ahead as well.
Yeah, they have for once not missed expectations. And Musk has been very buoyant, talking about 20 to 30% delivery growth for next year. His Cybertruck is now profitable. And he's been bigging up, I suppose you could say, the cyber cab, which has no pedals and a steering wheel. And he's going to target that at a $30,000 price point.
Well, let's, Anna, thanks very much. Anna McDonald, Investment Manager at Aubrey Capital Management there. Let's look at those Tesla figures in a bit more detail with Peter Bardenfleth Hansen. Peter's a former senior director of Tesla's Europe, Middle East and Asia arm. He's now the boss of the electric motor developer DG Innovate. Peter, morning.
Morning.
Was that the most interesting thing in the numbers, the strong sales forecasts for into next year?
Well, as Anna just laid out, definitely very, very good numbers, better than expected. The revenue slightly under the expectations, but most importantly, the margins were much higher than feared. And the general feeling in the market is that this is much better than was expected. And as Anna just touched on, early in the month, the market had felt that he wasn't really delivering when it came to the announcement on the RoboCab. This is sort of reaffirming Tesla's continued growth in the market. And that's why we're seeing this huge surge now in the share price.
If those are the maybes, the sort of might haves in the future, the big kind of big sky thinking that perhaps every tech company's got to have, was it the nuts and bolts that's actually done a bit of this, like tinkering with the price? I know investors at the time weren't very happy about that. Looks like looking at the numbers that slashing prices has worked.
It has. I mean, at the end of the day, I believe what's bringing the numbers back into the black here is definitely tinkering with the quote unquote old fashioned levers. I mean, he's not only slashed prices, but he's also slashed the OPEX. He's cut the workforce. He's reduced the payments on the supply chain, and basically all the, let's say, classical ways of making sure that you get a better margin is basically what he's done. But that's despite the fact that we are actually still seeing a very, very competitive market where margins are low.
Well, on that, sort of bucking a trend, isn't it? We've been talking about, I spoke to the boss of Volvo yesterday, pretty grim numbers from them about the sort of wider outlook. We've heard from VW as well. Still plenty of challenges sort of beyond some of the car makers' control in terms of adoption of EVs on a really mass scale.
Yeah, I mean, we have to be careful here because right now that's a very European-centric point of view. We're still seeing growth in China. We're seeing growth in India. We're seeing growth in many other markets outside of Europe. And remember, these are global OEMs, and most particularly when it comes to Tesla, who's really making sure that they have not all the eggs in one basket. But I completely concur with the CEO of Volvo on that point. I mean, we have to be very careful not to fall back into the same, let's say, sense that we had or the Europeans had 10 years ago. I mean, the Chinese will take over any time in the future if we don't continue down a strong path of e-mobility in Europe.
Peter Bardenfleth Hansen, former senior director at Tesla, thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you very much, Steve. Really, really interesting stuff on Tesla there. But now at 28 minutes past six, let's say good morning to Sarah Orchard, who's got the sport. Hi, Sarah.
A very good morning to you. Right then, the series decider between England and Pakistan got underway at 6 a.m. this morning in Rawalpindi. It's a match billed for the spinners, with England naming three for this one after Pakistan have been using patio heaters and giant fans to dry the surface of the pitch. Now, England won the toss. That's significant after they'd actually lost seven in a row. And they've decided to bat. So let's get the latest from chief cricket writer Stefan Schemmelt. Good morning, Stefan.
Morning, Sarah. England 36 without loss, jumping on that opportunity to bat first on the pitch that's generated so much attention. Like you mentioned, those unorthodox methods to dry it out, maybe getting to turn as the game goes on. 2 years ago, batting first in a test on this ground, England racked up a record 506 on the first day. Ben Duckett and Zach Crawley both made hundreds on that occasion, and they're in the middle now. Crawley has 18, as does Duckett. England 38 without loss.
And before I let you go, Stefan, they do look comfortable out there, but how comfortable is it in the TMS commentary box? Did the stray cat make it out or not?
I can confirm that the cat that we've christened Tuffers managed to sneak out overnight. No meowing so far interrupting the commentary.
Yes, of course, Phil Tufnell there with the nickname the cat, getting another cat to his name. Right then, we'll have more from Rawalpindi throughout the morning, but Test Match Special is live right now, of course, on Five Sports Extra. Now, later today, the government will introduce what it says is strengthened legislation to Parliament to establish an independent football regulator for the elite men's game in England. It's intended to improve clubs' financial stability and empower fans. The body will be given new powers, including over controversial parachute payments that are given to relegated Premier League clubs. Our sports editor, Dan Rowan, joins me now. Good morning, Dan. Just how significant are these changes?
Well, potentially important, Sarah. Initially tabled in March, the Football Governance Bill failed to pass through Parliament before the general election. It's now being introduced again, but with beefed up powers for the independent regulator that it establishes and which will oversee a licensing system to ensure clubs are run sustainably. It'll mean that these clubs must consult fans on changes to ticket prices, the relocation of home grounds, and improve their records on equality and diversity. As with the original bill, the regulator will have backstop powers to mediate a financial settlement if the Premier League and the English Football League fail to agree a new funding deal that would see more money flow down the pyramid. But it will now be able to consider parachute payments worth tens of millions of pounds to clubs relegated from the top flight when deciding how much the Premier League should redistribute. And finally, the regulator will not now have to consider government foreign policy when approving club takeovers. That seems to be a climb down, Sarah, after UEFA warned ministers last month that English football could be punished over concerns that this could lead to political interference in the sport.
Yeah, there was much made over that leaked letter, wasn't there? So what's the reaction been, Dan?
The Premier League says that while it recognises that key elements of the bill can help make the English game stronger, it remains concerned that the regulator's unprecedented and untested powers to intervene in the distribution of its revenues could have a negative impact on its competitiveness, investment and aspiration. But the EFL, Sarah, they said that they welcome the new bill, as did the Football Supporters Association and equality campaigners too.
Dan Rowan, our sports editor, thank you for your time this morning. And we're going to have more on this throughout the morning, including hearing from the chair of the English Football League, Rick Parry. That'll be at 7:25. Now, do keep an eye out for Erling Haaland's acrobatics on the BBC Sport website, as his goal inspired Manchester City to a 5-0 win over Sparta Prague last night in the Champions League. Liverpool also won with a 1-0 away victory over RB Leipzig, while Celtic drew 0-0 with Atalanta.
Sarah, thank you very much indeed. Yes, England going well at 40 for none now, off nine and a bit overs. Next week, Radio 4 investigates an unsolved mystery.
50 years ago, a crime took place that captured the British imagination. I want to find out why.
Part Dracula, part Scarlet Pimpernel, this figure that has haunted our national consciousness.
Lord Lucan is said to have killed the family nanny before attacking his wife and vanishing.
Some of the details are really... I don't think I can even sort of say them.
Come with me into a murky world of madness, myth and murder.
Wow, when the police got the lock off this door, you can really see why they believed Lord Lucan would have been hidden in here.
The Lucan Obsession with me, Alex von Tunselman, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Next Monday to Friday afternoon at 1:45.
It's 27 minutes to 7 and you are with us. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4. We're very happy about that, with Amal Rajan and Emma Barnett. And now let's get a summary of the news from Chris Aldridge.
The BBC understands that Commonwealth leaders are preparing to go against the UK at their summit in Samoa by agreeing to examine ways of getting reparatory justice for the transatlantic slave trade. That may include payments and an official apology. The British government has insisted reparations are not on the agenda and would not be paid. The sale and use of single-use disposable vapes are to be banned in England from next June. Ministers say they want to protect health and end a throwaway culture that blights communities. Similar bans are expected to be introduced at roughly the same time by the devolved governments in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. The public spending watchdog says the system supporting children and young people with special educational needs in England needs urgent reform. The National Audit Office says the current arrangement is letting down families and putting financial pressure on councils. The government says it is determined to rebuild confidence in the system. Police have arrested a 60-year-old woman on suspicion of manslaughter following the deaths of three people at a care home in Dorset. Officers say the deaths are being treated as unexplained, but the carbon monoxide poisoning is their main line of inquiry. Reports in the US suggest the Justice Department has written to Elon Musk, saying his giveaway of $1 million a day could be in violation of election law. To be eligible, people must have registered to vote in a key swing state and sign a petition on the Constitution and gun rights. Research suggests climate change is putting polar bears at a higher risk of contracting viruses, bacteria and parasites than they were 30 years ago. Scientists examined recent blood samples collected from wild polar bears and compared them with samples from the same location in the 1980s and 90s. The researchers say that as ice melts, the bears are forced to spend more time on land, exposing them to more germs.
Thanks very much, Chris. Now it's 25 to 7 and the BBC has learned that Commonwealth leaders, as you were just hearing in the news, mostly from the Caribbean, are preparing to defy the UK at a summit in Samoa and begin a debate about securing reparations for historic slavery. And yet, the Prime Minister says that is not on the table. James Landale, the BBC's diplomatic correspondent, has the story. It's not meant to be on the agenda. How's it going to perhaps get there, James?
There's a very sort of technical Commonwealth answer to that, which is technically it is not an agenda item. That's because agenda items are very specific and very and quite narrow. But that doesn't mean that it's not going to be discussed by Commonwealth leaders. It clearly is. And as I've discovered, it's going to be a core part of the communique. There are going to be three fat paragraphs in the summit communique, or at least there is at the moment.
Three before fat the leaders paragraphs. Get it. I like that, James. Sorry, just in terms of imagining it.
And essentially, those paragraphs are very explicit in saying, look, we need now to have what they call a meaningful, truthful and respectful conversation towards forging a common future about these discussions for reparatory justice for the transatlantic slave and what they call trade and what they call enslaved Africans and chattel enslavement. And very specifically, the leaders, according to this, the current draft of the communique, will agree to prioritise and facilitate further and additional research on the transatlantic trade. Now, this is not in any way committing the UK to apologising or promising any money in reparations. But what this is, it's the start of a debate that is beginning to take on official form. And that's why the British have been so keen to minimise what was in this text. There was a plan to have a separate declaration about this. The British managed to defeat that and see that off. But at the moment, it seems they are having to concede this language in the text.
Is there the hope, and I don't know if your conversations have revealed this, but is there the hope that the Labour government would be more open to this than the Conservatives, not least with the words of what David Lammy, the now Foreign Secretary, has shared in the past on this very subject?
No, I don't think it's quite got to that sort of level. I mean, Keir Starmer, en route to the summit in Samoa, you know, said very, very explicitly he wants this summit. Yes, he's happy to talk about this, but he actually what he wants to do is to talk about current issues, what he calls forward future facing issues, such as climate change, such as economic growth, rather than get caught up in what he calls long, endless discussions about reparations from the past. And, you know, there is some sympathy with that because there are countries in the Pacific who have a different experience to the Caribbean countries, who are the ones who are really pushing this reparations issue. And the Pacific countries, they have different experiences about this. Yes, they experienced forms of enslavement during the colonial era. The communique refers to this practice of what's called blackbirding, this idea of tricking or coercing people into slavery or low-income jobs throughout the colonies of the Pacific. But the Pacific Islanders, you know, they are facing real issues on climate change. So, for example, they said, no, we don't want a declaration on slavery. We want a declaration on oceans that are going to protect their economic zones that surround their islands, because at the moment, as these countries sink into the water, their coastlines get smaller and more reduced. And the more those coastlines get reduced, the smaller their economic zones become. And that's the sort of issue they
and
want
that's
to
the focus
focus
they
on, not about not okay. about slavery. But
well,
at the moment, we're going to
have to leave it there. But we are going to be hearing from the Foreign Minister of the Bahamas, Frederick Mitchell, just after 8 o'clock, about how he's planning to get this onto the agenda and what he's looking for. James Landell, our diplomatic correspondent, thank you.
21 minutes to 7, let's turn to vaping, because the sale and supply of single-use disposable vapes will be banned in England from June of next year. Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland all moving ahead with bans of their own. Let's speak to Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent. Henry, morning. So this is, just to take people back, this is something that Rishi Sunak's government, who are quite keen on sort of clamping down on smoking generally, had talked about but didn't get round to before they were thrown out of power.
Exactly right. This is the second time the UK government has announced this year. Rishi Sunak announced it in January when he was Prime Minister, but it wasn't enacted before the election. The Labour opposition, as they were then, had been supportive, but they didn't include it in their general election manifesto. So we didn't know for sure where they stood. But we now know that the sale and supply of single-use disposable vapes will be banned in England from June next year.
And this is quite popular with the public. I mean, there was a government consultation. You always got to be a little bit wary with these consultations that the government sort of asks for people's opinion and ends up finding that the people agree with the government. But there is evidence, isn't there, Henry, that people do think, broadly speaking, that these vapes are addictive. They're often targeted at children. And they often cause a lot of litter. And given all that, the government ought to do something about clamping down on them.
Well, and those are exactly the arguments the government is making here. So they're broadly categorising their arguments for banning these in two families. One is about protecting children's health and the other is about the environment. So when it comes to children's health, they say a quarter of children aged between 11 and 15 are thought to be using vapes of some form or another. Now, while the government's view is that vaping is a good thing if it's used as a way of weaning yourself off smoking, it's not a habit they want to inculcate in children. And then when it comes to the environment, the government says that in 2023, so last year, nearly 5 million disposable plastic vapes were thrown away each week. And that in itself was quadruple the number from 2022, the previous year. And they usually end up in landfill because they're difficult to recycle. Worth noting, by the way, this is separate to the government's plans for a tobacco and yes. vapes law. That is another thing the government has picked up from the Conservatives. That will essentially ban smoking for future generations, as well as various measures around the sale and marketing of vapes. But we also think that this government wants to go further than the previous government and is looking at certain things which could prove quite controversial, such as the possibility of banning smoking in other places like pub gardens.
Henry, always good to talk to you. Thank you.
19 minutes to 7. Let's turn our attention to the cost of special educational needs provision in England, which is spiralling, but the system isn't getting any better. That's according to new figures from the National Audit Office. In fact, families are losing confidence and two-fifths of local authorities are on the brink of effectively declaring bankruptcy over the issue. Bramwen Jeffries, our education editor, is here. Why are the costs rising, first of all, Bramwen?
It's a complex cocktail of factors which are... among them are the increase in diagnosis of autism. We've seen more problems coming out of the pandemic with an increase in speech and language and communication problems, what are categorised as social, emotional and mental health problems among children have also been increasing. So those are our drivers. And in addition to that, you have parents who find themselves in a very complex and frustrating system who find that the only way that they can get real help is to go for an education and healthcare plan which sets out their legal entitlement. And in many cases, that is going to provide them with a higher level of care. Although the amount per child has gone down and the outcomes aren't any better, and the state sector is having to rely on some very expensive independent school places as well.
Does the government have a plan? I know you've been talking to the Education Secretary.
There's no sense that they have either a big pot of money to put into this, and there is a huge hole in council finances, or an integrated and big reform plan. What Bridget Phillipson is talking about is trying to push more for mainstream schools to be better at including pupils with special educational needs and to address some of the issues much, much earlier. So the government is putting money, for example, into more speech and language help for young children, recognising that after the COVID lockdowns, amongst many other factors, that has become a big issue for children going into primary school. And if it's not addressed early, that does lead to significant problems later on.
Bronwyn Jeffries, thank you. We'll be hearing from more people throughout the programme on this subject. We know it is an issue, the cost and the provision of special educational needs, even being certified to receive it, is a huge issue for many of you. We'd like to hear your experiences of it. Do WhatsApp us on 0330 123 4346. That's 0330 123 4346. You can send a message, or better still, you can record us a voice note. Always lovely to hear your voices, quite literally. Or email us today at bbc.co.uk and let us know. We're going to be hearing from one mother a bit later on in the programme who really had to take matters into her own hands after her son was incorrectly assessed and then had a terrible experience at one school, having been restrained through a weighted blanket and also lost on a school trip for 45 minutes. So do stay with us for that.
But now, at 7:15, it's time for your stay in Parliament, because yesterday was a day for deputies. Keir Starmer is on his way to a Commonwealth Leaders Summit in Samoa, which we've been hearing about. And so it was time for Angela Rayner, the Deputy Prime Minister, and Sir Oliver Dowden from the Conservatives to take the floor at PMQs. And as our parliamentary correspondent, Alicia McCarthy, reports, there was an outbreak of cross-party cordiality.
Right from the start, this week's PMQs had a rather less febrile feel. That wry little cheer for the Tories' deputy leader Sir Oliver Dowden as he took his seat at 5 to 12. Last Wednesday, Rishi Sunak surprised Westminster by using his questions not to ask about the week's front page news, but instead about the UK's relations with China. This week, Oliver Dowden took a more direct approach. With Labour's first budget looming, he wanted to know,
what is the Deputy Prime Minister's definition of working people?
That, of course, being a reference to a Labour manifesto promise not to raise taxes for workers. The Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, began with a barbed welcome to her opposite number.
Today's our first exchange, Mr Speaker, since he pushed for a July general election.
As to Oliver Dowden's question...
And Mr Speaker, the definition of working people are the people that the Tory party have failed for the last 14 years.
Oliver Dowden reckoned that was dismissive of 5 million small business owners.
These are the publicans, the shopkeepers, the family running a local cafe. None of those count as working people to her.
He quoted the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves.
Even the Chancellor said that raising employer national insurance was a jobs tax that will make each new recruit more expensive and increase the cost to business.
Angela Rayner said she remembered what Boris Johnson was reported to have said.
What was it? F to business? Whereas this party held an investment international investment summit last week, which brought £63 million into our economy. We're pro-business, pro-worker and getting on with fixing the mess that they left behind.
Next week's budget comes just days before the new Conservative leader takes over. It's expected he or she will bring their own deputy on board, making this Oliver Dowden's last appearance filling in at PMQs.
As this is our last exchange across the dispatch box.
MPs oohed and aahed. Sitting next to Oliver Dowden, Jeremy Hunt smiled, as did Rachel Reeves, a touch more apprehensively.
I'd like to turn to somebody I hope we can all agree is a hard-working person, His Majesty the King. Yeah.
Oliver Dowden asked if Angela Rayner would join him in sending King Charles best wishes ahead of the Commonwealth Summit and commit to deepening the UK's relationship with it. The Deputy Prime Minister had a confession to make.
I will miss our exchanges.
Oliver Dowden grinned from ear to ear.
The Battle of the Gingers. The late nights voting.
And in a spirit of unity, Angela Rayner agreed that the King did a tremendous job and the Commonwealth was important. By now, Oliver Dowden was positively enjoying himself.
Our Commonwealth family is brought together by historical and cultural ties. Indeed, much like the pair of us. But
on the opposite bench, Angela Rayner let go of her folder and made her fingers into a little heart symbol.
I will resist, Mr. Speaker, the temptation to replicate that.
He repeated his call for closer Commonwealth ties, while Angela Rayner repeated her attack on the last government's record. Daisy Cooper was standing in for the Lib Dem leader, Sir Ed Davey. She too worried about the potential impact of a rumoured increase to employers' national insurance contributions.
It would affect millions of small businesses, including 18,000 small care providers. Can I ask the Deputy Prime Minister to assure this House that there will be nothing in the budget that makes it harder for vulnerable people to access the care workers and the care that they desperately need?
The Deputy Prime Minister said with the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, sitting beside her, she wasn't about to speculate on what was in the budget. The SNP's Westminster leader, Stephen Flynn, had been swept up in the outbreak of cross-party bonhomie and wondered if Angela Rayner would join him.
In applauding the brave Labour staff members who've travelled across the Atlantic to campaign against Donald Trump.
Sitting behind him, DUP MPs chuckled at that reference to a complaint by Donald Trump's supporters that members of the Labour Party are interfering in the US election campaign. Angela Rayner welcomed the tone of the question, at least.
Mr. Speaker, I'm loving this loving.
As to those Labour Party staffers visiting the United States, she said people from all parties often went to campaign in their own time and with their own money.
And you can hear more on events in Yesterday in Parliament at 9 o'clock on Radio 4 Extra.
It's 10 to 7. The World Health Organization says it's been forced to postpone a planned mass polio vaccination campaign across most of northern Gaza, blaming escalating violence and a lack of assured humanitarian pauses. Hamish Young is UNICEF's Senior Emergency Coordinator for Gaza, and I spoke to him a short time ago.
Firstly, let me clarify, it is delayed. It is not cancelled. All parties, and particularly UNICEF, WHO and UNRWA and the Ministry of Health, are determined to see this through to the finish. The reason it's been delayed is because of the ongoing heavy conflict at the northern part of Gaza. There was an offensive started there at the beginning of this month that's seen over 770 people killed. There's continuous airstrikes and bombardments of the schools that have been used as shelters. And this has just made it impossible right at this moment to conduct a polio campaign in that area. The healthcare workers, if nothing else, are swamped with dealing with large numbers of trauma cases, people injured, people burnt, people suffering crush wounds, bullet wounds, shrapnel wounds. But we are determined to get back there and complete the campaign as soon as we possibly can.
And just to say, people will remember this from the pandemic, but it's in the nature of vaccines that you often need a second jab. So what you actually are often looking for is a second chance to get to these children and get this vaccine into their arms. And to do that, you need a humanitarian pause, and you also need health facilities and staff who can administer those injections safely.
The population up there, the child under 10 population, who's our targets, probably most of them have already had one shot, but they definitely need a second shot to ensure that they're protected from polio. And it's very important that we vaccinate all the children. It's actually quite risky to only vaccinate part of them, because you risk actually seeding another outbreak if you only partially vaccinate a population of children.
How much polio, as far as you know, is there in Gaza?
It's hard to estimate. We've had some positive samples and a couple of cases tested positive. With the state of the healthcare system and the state of the sewerage system, it's very difficult to do testing and surveillance. So the environmental sampling indicated that, that the virus was widespread across the strip. Fortunately, Gaza has a history of very, very high vaccination rates, you know, higher than a lot of Western countries, I might add. So there is a lot of built-up protection over the years, which is doing its job now. The children who were born in the last year since the fighting started are the ones obviously most at risk, because that's the time where the primary healthcare system and routine vaccination has been heavily impacted. Although I might add, you know, UNICEF, the Ministry of Health, WHO, are still making efforts to maintain routine vaccination. And in fact, we're looking at ways to boost it up again even further.
And Hamish, for those who aren't following the war, obviously as closely, or the wars as closely as you are, it's been over a year now since those Hamas attacks on October the 7th. Just give us your sense of the overall picture in the Gaza Strip.
The overall situation is dire, Mol. I mean, there's been over 40,000 civilian casualties, over 15,000 of those are children. There's 97 people still held hostage. I think it's important to remember that. These are not just numbers. These are mums and dads, sons and daughters, granddads, grandmas. There are intolerable conditions across the strip, and they're getting worse. Kids have been particularly impacted. There's 1 year out of school now. There's not enough food, and there's not enough of the right types of food. So we're seeing child malnutrition increasing again, because in the last month there's been a significant reduction in the amount of aid that can get in. The sewage systems are destroyed, and that's what's one of the factors driving disease outbreak, including polio. So this relentless war just goes on and on. We must have a ceasefire now.
Hamish Young from UNICEF in Gaza, thank you very much indeed.
6 minutes to seven. Let's go to where the Chancellor is, because she's travelled to Washington. She's talking to global finance ministers at the International Monetary Fund annual meeting and is expected to confirm changes to the way the Treasury limits its borrowing. Faisal Islam is there with her, our economics editor. And he told me about what Rachel Reeves is expected to announce later today.
The headlines of what we're told she'll announce about the budget officially is some kind of warm words to an audience of financiers, of finance ministers and of central bankers about the budget next week, that it will, quote unquote, invest in the foundations of future growth. Now, the significance of those words is that, having heard a lot about filling a black hole, we're now hearing a sort of different narrative about investment, investment, investment. And what comes with that is the sort of much vaunted changes to the fiscal rules, the self-imposed limits on borrowing that she inherited from the previous government, that'll be tweaked. It'll be like a twin pack of changes. On the one hand, the rule that limits day-to-day spending, that's on departments, on welfare, on interest, well, they'll be tightened. You could only spend money that you've raised in tax revenue and not borrow. But the rule to limit debt, which has curtailed the amount of investment you can do, that's going to be loosened so that more investment, potentially tens of billions, could be done theoretically. Now, there won't be tens of billions of new investment announced, but the space for that will be created by a looser rule on the national debt.
You know, I'm not the Chancellor. I didn't know you could do that. Can you do that? Can you just create, you know, this sort of space in the economy, in the way our finances work?
One way to look at this is that the Treasury, in general, since the new government came along, has been critical of what came before. That there were changes made to the rules that restricted the ability to invest, that didn't necessarily restrict the ability to do what they would say was bad infrastructure investment that didn't have much of a return, but did restrict the ability to do good investments. So what they say is, well, let's not have arbitrary limits that hold back growth. Let's control infrastructure investment by picking good projects. And, we can accommodate this with a change in the measure. So they are regularly changed, is the reality. And the proof of the pudding in rules like this is, are they credible, especially to markets? And this is why something like the IMF, where you do have the markets present, the big bankers are present, as well as finance ministers, is the sort of place where you'd want to sort of seed the idea that this change will help growth in the economy. And it's also helpful that the IMF, speaking to the BBC, have backed the idea in general of more investment. They've said that Britain has had lower investment than other equivalent economies over the past few years, and that more investment is needed.
What is the response from the IMF?
I think it's fair to say that this is probably not the main item on their agenda right now. They're, they are sort of relaxed, relieved that the world economy has come in for a soft landing after 3 years of inflationary crisis. They're a bit worried about levels of debt, which is why some of these rules are important. But in general terms, all eyes actually here, although it's not on the official agenda, is obviously on the US election, where the increasing probability or possibility of Donald Trump's re-election is focusing attention on trade policy and the idea that he might levy tariffs on every single import from every country, including the UK, if he got elected.
Faisal Islam, our economics editor.
Was Anne Boleyn really a wicked queen?
People feared women who were smart.
Slay girl.
Exactly.
What about Rasputin? A miraculous mystic or a diehard deviant?
I think there's some bad stuff in there. I do weirdly respect him.
On Evil Genius, we're the judges of that. Join me, Russell Kane, and a host of comedians as we put more historical legends under scrutiny to find out if they're evil or genius. Evil Genius. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Let's get a bit of the weather, shall we, after that? Sarah Keith-Lucas is here.
Thanks, Emma. Well, mainly fine and dry out there today. Best of the sunshine will be in the east. So for southeast England, eastern England, the Midlands and northeast England, any early morning mist and fog should clear away pretty quickly. And then long spells of sunshine and temperatures 17 or 18 degrees. For the rest of the UK, we've got a little bit more cloud around, quite a blustery winds coming in from the south, more persistent rain for the Western Isles and highs of 14 to 18 degrees.
Sarah, thanks very much for that. You are listening to Today on Radio 4. Good to have you with us with Amol Rajan and Emma Barnett. Good morning. If you're just joining us, it is 7 o'clock on Thursday, the 24th of October. The headlines. Commonwealth leaders are to plan to examine ways of making amends for historic slavery against the wishes of the UK. A ban on disposable vapes is to come into force in England from next June. A report says increased spending on special educational needs hasn't helped families or prevented councils from facing financial hardship. And coming up in the next hour on this programme, you'll be hearing from the Culture Secretary, Lisa Nandy, on how she's going to regulate football. And the doctor and broadcaster, Chris Van Tulleken, on why salt and sugar taxes may be the answer to combating rising obesity, which has been described as a public health crisis. And...
ow! It's stinging. Ah, how is that not stinging you?
Safe from extinction and now being bred to bloodsuck for the NHS. No, we are not going back in time or horrible histories here. The strange story of the medicinal leech. All that to come and more. But first, the BBC News is read by Chris Aldridge.
The BBC has learned that Commonwealth leaders are preparing to defy the UK at their summit in Samoa by agreeing to examine ways of securing reparatory justice for the transatlantic slave trade. That could include payments and an official apology. Yesterday, the Prime Minister said that while there was no question slavery was abhorrent, he wanted the meeting on the Pacific Island to focus on the here and now. Our diplomatic correspondent James Landale has this exclusive report.
Sir Keir Starmer wants the Commonwealth Summit to discuss existing challenges such as economic growth and climate change. But Caribbean leaders want to begin a debate about securing reparations for historic slavery, much of which involved Britain. And it looks like they may get it. I've been told the draft summit communique says the time has come for a meaningful, truthful and respectful conversation about reparatory justice for what it calls the transatlantic trade in enslaved Africans. It also says Commonwealth leaders will agree to prioritise and facilitate further and additional research into the issue. A UK government spokesman said reparations were not on the agenda and would not be paid. The Prime Minister told reporters he did not want endless discussions about reparations. But diplomats said the clock was now ticking on a debate that potentially could one day cost Britain billions of pounds.
The Foreign Minister of the Bahamas, Frederick Mitchell, has told this programme he believes Sir Keir Starmer and the Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, will change their minds.
Once you broach the subject, it may take a while for people to come around, but come around they will.
given Sir Keir's work before he became prime minister, given Mr. Lammy's position before he got this job that he has now. They bring their individual consciences to this job, and I think eventually they'll come around to the position.
And you can hear the full interview at 8:10. Single-use vapes are to be banned in England from next June. The government says 8 of the devices are thrown away every second. It's also worried about the impact of vaping on children's health. Here's our political correspondent, Damien Grammaticus.
The government says this ban is about ending a throwaway culture that blights towns and cities and reducing the appeal of vapes to children. Almost 10% of people in the UK, including a quarter of children aged 11 to 15, are thought to use vapes. They throw away nearly 5 million of the disposable plastic devices each week, often as litter. Powered by lithium batteries, which can easily ignite, the vapes can't be refilled and are difficult to recycle. Many end up in landfill or are incinerated. A ban was announced in January by Rishi Sunak when he was Prime Minister, but not enacted before the election. The government says sales in England will be illegal from the 1st of June and is hoping to align that with Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, which are already moving ahead with bans of their own.
The public spending watchdog says the system supporting children and young people with special educational needs in England is in need of urgent reform. The National Audit Office says the current arrangement is financially unsustainable and is letting down families. The government says it's determined to rebuild confidence in the system. Here's our education editor, Branwyn Jeffries.
The National Audit Office describes a system where costs are spiralling without making the lives of children and young people significantly better. To meet their legal obligations, councils have spent more, accumulating large deficits. Growing numbers of parents have applied for legally binding education, health and care plans, resulting in a third less being spent on each child with a plan. A shortage of special needs school places has also led to an expensive reliance on independent ones. The Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, says it will take time to turn the system around.
Turkey says its military has struck sites in Iraq and Syria linked to the Kurdish militant group the PKK after blaming it for an attack on a state-owned defence company near Ankara that killed at least 5 people. Defence officials said 32 targets had been destroyed so far. Police have arrested a 60-year-old woman on suspicion of manslaughter following the deaths of 3 people at a care home in Dorset. Officers say the deaths are being treated as unexplained, but that carbon monoxide poisoning is their main line of inquiry. Louisa Pelbeam reports.
Emergency services were called to the Gainsborough care home in Swanage yesterday morning, where they found 3 residents had died. 7 other people were taken to hospital and the home was evacuated with around 40 residents, some of whom have dementia and complex needs, being taken to a nearby church. Dorset police said a 60-year-old local woman has been arrested and they would be investigating whether there had been any actions or omissions that were grossly negligent.
Ministers are bringing back to Parliament what they say are strengthened plans to create an independent regulator for elite men's football. They say the draft legislation will tackle rogue owners, improve club finances and put fans at the heart of the game. The Premier League says it has reservations. Here's our sports editor, Dan Rowan.
Initially tabled in March, the Football Governance Bill failed to pass through Parliament before the general election. Today the government will reintroduce it, but with beefed up powers for the independent regulator it will create. It will mean clubs must engage with fans on issues such as changes to ticket prices and improve their record on equality and diversity. The regulator will also have the power to redistribute the tens of millions of pounds that the Premier League gives to relegated clubs, to teams lower down the football pyramid. And it will not have to consider government foreign and trade policy when approving club takeovers. The Premier League says it remains concerned that the regulator's unprecedented powers to intervene in the distribution of its revenues could have a negative impact on its competitiveness, investment and aspiration.
The families of footballers who died from a condition linked to repetitive head impacts have written to the government, calling for it to become mandatory for anyone who's played contact sport to be checked for evidence of neurodegenerative disease when they die. Chronic traumatic encephalopathy can only be conclusively diagnosed by examining the brain after death. Research has found that polar bears are at a higher risk of contracting viruses, bacteria and parasites than they were 30 years ago because of climate change. In a study published in the journal PLOS One, scientists examined recent blood samples collected from wild polar bears and compared them with samples that were collected in the same part of the Arctic in the 1980s and 90s. Our science correspondent Victoria Gill explains.
In a warming Arctic, the ice that polar bears use as a platform from which to pounce on seals is melting. This is forcing the bears to spend more time on land. Scientists from the US Geological Survey wanted to understand how this change affected the predators' risk of contracting certain parasites, viruses and bacteria, pathogens that are mainly associated with land-based animals. They compared recent blood samples from polar bears in the Chukchi Sea between Alaska and Russia with those collected 30 years ago in the same area. 5 of the 6 different viruses, bacteria and parasites that they tested for were more common in the recently collected samples. The researchers say that since polar bears are top predators, this is a signal that the prevalence of wildlife disease is changing throughout the Arctic ecosystem, another unexpected biological side effect of climate change.
Victoria Gill reporting.
Chris, thank you very much indeed. It's 9 minutes past seven. The sale and supply of single-use disposable vapes will be banned in England from June next year, as you just heard from Chris Aldridge. The aim is to protect the environment and children. Rishi Sunak and his government had announced a ban, but didn't get round to it while in power. The statistics aren't always reliable in this domain, but it's estimated that around 10% of people in Britain, including a quarter of children aged 11 to 15, use vapes. Nearly 5 million of the disposable plastic devices are thrown away each week, often as litter, ending up in landfill. They've got lithium batteries, which can easily ignite. And Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland are all moving ahead with bans of their own. But is there a case for the defence, as it were? What does the vaping industry think? Well, John Dunn is the Director General of the UK Vaping Association and joins us now. John, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thank you. I'm very grateful for your company and giving us your time on a day where the government seems to be announcing things that you might not like, so we appreciate it. The government, the move the government's making does appear to be quite popular. 69% of respondents to a, admittedly a government consultation in February supported the restriction of sale and supply of single-use vapes. What's the argument against doing that?
Well, I think the way it's structured at the moment is just not going to work. One of the major concerns, at least with the last version of the bill that I saw prior to the new government coming in, didn't include, for instance, a ban on the importation of the products that they're going to ban for sale. So in my view, that's just going to fuel a black market. And the other interesting thing is that research from the Association for Convenience Stores that came out in the last couple of weeks found that 25% of vapers will continue to use disposables despite a ban, because they're still easily available, A, from sources outside of the UK, through online sales, etc. But also domestically, we have a black market in vaping products already that the authorities can't really keep up with. So now this is going to be dropped right on their lap as well.
But that might be an argument to do something about the black market. That's not what you're saying, isn't an argument against doing something about the vaping products themselves and the fact that children are using them.
No, but the other issue we have with it is that the recycling industry has been or was preparing to tool up with automated machines to deal with the amount of vapes that were coming through. We had a webinar this week with them talking about what's happening with the environment, etc. And they said they scrapped the plans now to do it because they know that the volume of products coming through to them will not be the same, and they can't deal with illegal products either. So it's while I understand the concept behind it, it just wasn't very well thought out.
Sure, and I hear what you say about the practicalities, but the reason these products might not be reaching those people might be because fewer people are using the vapes, and you can see why from the point of view of the public, from the point of view of the government responding to the public, if you've got a huge number of children using, at the age of 11 to 15, an addictive product, which also happens to cause a huge amount of litter. It's not difficult to understand why a lot of people might say you need to clamp down on this stuff.
Well, absolutely, but bans and prohibition have never worked.
So what would you do about the fact that all these 11-year-olds in the country are using vapes? Single-use vapes?
Well, first of all, we have been calling on the government to introduce a licensing scheme for all retailers and distributors of vaping products, which will include things like mandatory age verification processes, for instance. Because we're seeing shops like, I'm seeing hairdressers selling these things, you know, butcher shops even selling vapes. It's just absolutely ridiculous. And we also want to see the fines given out to retailers that break these rules to be massively increased. We had a case about 2 years ago where a court fined a store £26 for selling to a 14-year-old on two separate occasions. Now, we want to see that fine a minimum of £10,000 per instance. So the industry wants to do the right thing, but the government, at least the previous government, wasn't listening to that. Now, the good thing is the conversations I've had recently with the new MPs in Parliament, there's a huge upswell of support for that type of
licensing,
for
agreement.
That type of scheme.
Yeah.
Because the problem is there's no point in bringing in new laws if you can't enforce the laws that are already in place.
Okay. All right. Hear you loud and clear. John Dunn, Director General of the UK Vaping Association. Thank you very much indeed.
14 minutes past seven. Let's talk about education and the hope of it, because it is a fundamental hope of all parents that their children receive an education that equips them for the world, that in the most basic terms, that they come out of school better than how they went in. But for parents of children with special educational needs, that confidence in the system is being lost, even while more and more money is being paid into the system to try and support it and, you know, help it be as good as it can in some ways. The spending watchdog, the National Audit Office, today outlines a system with spiralling costs and declining outcomes at a time of hugely growing numbers of children needing support. We know this causes many of you, our listeners, a great deal of trouble. So we do want to take a detailed look at this situation from different perspectives and ask what we need to do to fix it. And at the start of the last hour, at the start of the programme, I asked you to, if you could, get in touch or send us a voice note with your own experiences. Here's one we've just received.
My name's Tania. I'm a mother in London of a young adopted boy who is now in secondary school. It was the most traumatic event in his life, having to go in there. And he has an EHCP for anxiety. And the structures in school, the behavioural policies, the dictatorial systems are so, so damaging to so many of our children, never mind those with additional needs. And this is a crisis that is just pushing more and more mental health across all of our children. It's so obvious to any parent. They don't even have to be a SEND parent. And there is nothing there to support, despite the statutory protection, despite I'm supposed to get adoption care, post-adoption care, supposed to be voluntary school support. There is nothing virtual school support for adopted children. You try and call out, and it could be a month and before anyone calls you back. It's broken and people are just left.
The EHCP, Tanya mentioned there, is an education, health and care plan that's required for young people up to the age of 25 who need more support than is available through special educational needs support. Tanya, thank you very much for sharing that. And it sounds incredibly difficult what you're going through, and many will be able to relate. And there will also be teachers listening to this who are trying to do their level best in the system, but will know how it's working and how it's not. Simon Kidwell, head teacher at Hertford Manor Primary School and Nursery in Cheshire, is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning.
What picture are you seeing? Are you seeing an increase?
Yes, I've been a head teacher for 20 years and I've noticed there's been a large increase, and that's supported by the National Audit Office report, where we've seen an increase of 140%. And I think particularly, Emma, it's been around the increase in the number of children with speech and language and communication difficulties, with behaviour needs and with autistic needs as well. So that's where the increase is being seen, and that's supported by the report.
A bit later in the programme, we're going to get into why on that. But if I could ask for the time we have for you to tell us a bit about what you are able to do to support those children or not.
Well, so in terms of children, we have to provide the first tranche of funding for children with needs. So that's £6,000 out in the school budget. We then give them additional support, often from a teaching assistant. And employing and finding those skilled teaching assistants is becoming increasingly more difficult as teaching assistants are leaving our schools to work in better paid jobs as well. We've got an excellent special needs coordinator in our school who's really good at working with the parents and working with local authorities to secure additional funding, but we do have a limit in the resource that we have, and we've seen this large increase in special needs pupils has been not matched by the increase in funding, even though we have to say the previous government did invest a lot in special needs, but it's just not keeping pace.
So what happens if you can't support? Where do the children, what do they do? What do you do?
Well, there's special schools, but in our local area, but we've had some children where they've said that children need to go to special school, but there's not been any space. So we then have to go and think very carefully and work hard to make sure we're providing the best we can with our resource. But we know that some children, their needs will be better met in a specialist provision with specialist trained staff, with specialist school facilities.
And is that what you're hoping for from this new government? You know, the education secretary she knows the scale of the problem, but there isn't a clear solution being put forward at this point.
I mean, the costs involved are eye-watering. I think what I'd like to see from new governments is early intervention. I think what the failing of the system has been is we've seen a 40% reduction in health visitors since 2015. And that has meant we've not been able to identify children's needs early and work with families. So we've seen children coming into our nursery and our early years department with significant speech and language delay. So that's something I'd like them to do. And also, I think we've seen a real gap in the support for families with the reduction in sure start provision. That's been something which we've seen over a decade, where families were getting support for needs and for other aspects of making sure we had early intervention. So I think those two things, I think we've got to intervene earlier rather than just putting a sticking plaster on the problem.
Simon Kidwell, head teacher at Hertford Manor Primary School and Nursery in Cheshire. Thank you. Got a message here from one of our listeners saying, this system's been crumbling for years. I'm a head in a mainstream state primary. We opened a special educational needs base last year. Currently teach 12 children who have greater needs than standard mainstream and will be able to provide effectively. My school's always been proud of inclusion. As well as the pupils in this base, we teach children with other considerable needs in our mainstream classes. One of the issues is school budgets have been cut and cut, so staff need to be cut. No classes in my school have general class teaching assistants, only those funded by the certificates we talked about, and the children without those plans would have traditionally been supported in class by these additional practitioners no longer have access to this. Please do keep your messages coming in.
Yeah, keep them coming in. 20 past seven, just to let you know, England have lost 2 wickets, 75 for two, since we last talked about the sport. But we're going to talk business now with Will Bain and the UK hospitality sector, which presumably has some demands of the budget, Will.
Yeah, let's skip the cricket. This time next week we'll know what's in the budget, but until that point, yeah, those demands keep coming. We heard a little bit earlier on, didn't we, from Britain's biggest pub group, Stonegate. This is their chief executive, David McDowell, talking business rates.
These days, they probably make around about 12 pence of profit for every pint of beer that they sell. And the removal of that business rates relief means that for small publicans, it's likely that in many cases, their business rates bill will quadruple from April. And with the complete burden of the cost, inflation and regulatory pressure that they're facing at the moment, they don't have any more to give.
Kate Nichols, the Chief Executive of the trade body UK Hospitality, is in the studio with us this morning. Morning, Kate.
Good morning.
What is it then about business rate and rate relief in particular? Is it who counts to get it? Is it the value of it? Why is it causing such an issue for the issue?
Well, it's the value of it at the present moment in time. So business rates, we bear a disproportionate burden across hospitality and high street businesses. We generate 5% of GDP in the hospitality sector, but we pay 15% of rates. So it's a disproportionately large portion of our tax bill. And when that relief ends in April, nobody in the sector's paid full business rates since 2020. But when that relief ends, you'll see business rates bills on average increasing by £12,000 for a community pub, £25 for a neighbourhood standard restaurant and 40 for a guest house. And put simply, with paper-thin margins, as David was explaining, that's not sustainable. So you're going to undermine and erode business viability.
When you say not sustainable, does that mean that places will close?
Yes, independent businesses will close. You've got a third of businesses across the sector operating at or below break-even. And for the larger sectors who can sustain that increase, but a quadrupling of bills, £1 billion tax bill, is a lot for the industry to absorb at this point in time. It will deter and disincentivise investment, and it will impact jobs and growth across our communities.
The Prime Minister, when he was leader of the opposition, said that business reviewing business rates was a priority. In fact, said that they were holding small businesses back. We haven't in the media heard much about what changes might be there. Have they been speaking to you about what the changes might be?
Well, we've been speaking to them a lot about business rates because it is a burning platform. I think everybody agrees that it needs root and branch reform. You've got the high street businesses in hospitality and retail paying just under half of all business rates bills. So that's a system that's creaking at the seams. What we need to see at the budget is a roadmap for that reform. It was heartened by the fact the minister in Parliament this week said that they would do that. But in the meantime, we need a bridge. We need a permanent lower multiplier for hospitality businesses to rebalance the costs that they are bearing.
Action as well as words.
Absolutely. We need root and branch reform, but we need a bridge to get us there to avoid that cliff edge in April, extend the reliefs.
Kate Nichols, Chief Executive of Hospitality UK, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks very much, Will. Well, to something else entirely, because the Ping Pong Parkinson World Championship is an annual table tennis competition that brings people together with Parkinson's disease from around the world. And I'm thrilled now to be able to talk to the person who just won gold in the ladies singles in that tournament. Formerly of this parish is a BBC correspondent, Gillian Lacey-Solimar, who, alongside friends including Jeremy Paxman and Mark Mardell, also hosts Movers and Shakers. You may have heard it, a podcast about life with Parkinson's. Gillian, good morning and congratulations.
Thank you so much. I feel as if I'm living in a parallel universe. I just cannot believe that this has actually happened.
No, I bet, because as I understand it, you weren't a ping pong player before.
Not only was I not a ping pong player, I'm not sporty at all. And the irony, of course, is that if I were able-bodied, still I'd never have won anything at all. I mean, but I was so proud. This sounds ridiculous, but they played the national anthem and I was standing up trying to look terribly serious, but actually smirking away, because it was something I had never expected would happen. But the very best thing about it all was the effect it had on my health. It was amazing. Well, and
That's what I was going to say, because the fact that there is this championship would speak to the fact that there is significant benefit for those living with Parkinson's.
Yeah, I mean, the only disease-modifying thing out there is exercise, and it has to be a specific sort of exercise. Exercise which combines mind and body, which means that you have to be thinking at the same time about something else, preferably, as your body is charging around. So ping pong does exactly that, because you're running around the table and at the same time you're trying to strategize, thinking, oh, if I put it at the back, are they less likely to get it? Then will they put it at my front, etc.? So you're constantly thinking. And it works wonders. It really does. I mean, one of the things that goes is parallel processing, the ability to do two things at the same time. And I've got it back. I mean, it may only be temporary, but I have got it back for now.
And did that happen while you were playing? Is that what you realised? Or it then goes into your everyday life?
Do you know, I don't know the answer to that yet, because it did happen while I was playing. But I've become completely obsessed with the game. So I've been playing an hour every day since I got back. And it's still there. So I don't know. I'll have to report back what happens when I or if I ever stop playing.
With your reporting hat on. Although it must feel something, though, to, as you are with your podcast as well, to be trying to live report how things are for you and get those experiences out there and share with others and hear from them.
Yeah, I mean, it's not every time. I get far more nervous than I ever used to being on air, because you get this brain fog. I mean, there are 40 different symptoms that you get with Parkinson's. It's not just a movement disorder, which is what people thought it was. There are all these other things, like the night fog, there are night terrors, there are the sleeplessness. I bet I sleep as little as you do. There is also balance. You know, you fall over, your voice. I mean, Mark Mardell, if you think about him, he had such a strong booming voice and it's got weaker and weaker. And he's fighting very hard to put it back and he's succeeding on the whole. But those are all symptoms that are dreadful. And when your producer rang to ask me to do this, I was actually writhing on the carpet in agony at the time. Okay. You know, it's not a cheery illness at all, and there is no cure at the moment.
I'm so sorry to hear that, but I also think being honest about it will is a very important part, and there'll be a lot of people will be able to resonate or helping somebody living with this. So thank you for your honesty, and you know, huge congratulations being at the ping pong table when you're not in that discomfort, that extreme discomfort. I hope it keeps bringing you joy and improvement. And what a turn of events, quite literally, in this part of your life and with this illness. Gillian Lacey-Solomon there.
27 minutes past seven, and England have lost another wicket. Joe Root now, this is looking a bit grim, isn't it, Sarah?
You don't need me anymore, do you, Martin?
so despondent.
Well, let's get the sports news. Yes, it is the series decider between England and Pakistan. It got underway at 6 a.m. this morning in Rawalpindi, and so much was made in the build-up about the state of the pitch after Pakistan were using patio heaters and giant fans to try and dry out the surface. Spin was expected to be king, and of course, England, they won the toss. That was exciting because they'd lost seven in a row before that. They decided to bat, but so much action. Wickets are tumbling. Joe Root, the latest to walk. Let's get the latest from cricket correspondent Jonathan Agnew.
Yeah, good morning to you. 81 for three. Fascinating morning. You're right, it was a key toss, but winning the toss is only part of this. You've actually got to bat well. And England are in a bit of a crisis situation here. Crawley was out, a poor shot, carving a catch to backward point for 29. Ollie Pope sweeping. Was that the right decision? At this stage, the ball's not spinning very much. It's just doing that little bit. So he was out, LBW for three, playing that sweep shot. And now a big wicket, Joe Root, obviously the main batsman for England. LBW to Sajid, the cabaddy-loving off spinner. He's out for five. So we've got Brooke Duckett, well set, is there. He's on 40, but it's 81 for three.
Thank you so much, our cricket correspondent Jonathan Agnew there, and we'll have more from Rawalpindi throughout the morning, but Test Match Special is live now on Five Sports Extra. Now, later today, the government will introduce what it says is strengthened legislation to Parliament to establish an independent football regulator for the elite men's game in England. Intended to improve clubs' financial stability and empower fans, the body will be given new powers, including over controversial parachute payments that are given to relegated Premier League clubs. We're joined this morning by English Football League Chair Rick Parry. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, this sounds like a bit of a victory for the EFL, but to bring everyone along with us on this story, Rick, can you just explain to us why these parachute payments were causing so many problems?
I don't think we'd describe it as a victory. We're very pleased. We welcome the legislation. Congratulations to Lisa Nandy and the government for responding promptly, and it's such a contrast from 9 months ago. And by the way, we're totally in favour of better regulation with transparency and consistency. Parachutes are one aspect, and the issue in the last bill was that they were outside the scope of backstop powers. Point we'd made that if we went back to 2021, parachute payments to clubs in the Championship amounted to £233 million. The remainder of the clubs shared £79 million between them. Parachutes were cuckoo in the nest, totally disproportionate, and we said it was fiddling while Rome burns, that the regulator could address the £79 million, but not the £233 million. We don't want to stop parachute payments. Nobody is trying to kill the relegated clubs. That absolutely isn't the point. The point is they have to be considered as part of the system. We're not against proportionate support for clubs that are relegated. But it's all about fair competition. We can't have a situation where 7 years running, two out of the three clubs to be promoted are the parachute clubs. It's destroying competitive balance in the Championship.
And can I just jump in there, Rick, before we run out of time? Because on the payments themselves, I mean, ultimately, you want to see these parachute payments included in the whole Premier League accounting periods, not just sort of siphoned off. So is the Premier League's hand ultimately being forced here?
Yeah, the regulator will have the powers to address them. And that's all we really wanted, to make sure that they're considered in the round. And what we're looking for is sporting jeopardy without financial catastrophe. And it's that ability just to consider the whole of the distributions picture. So in that sense, we're very pleased going forwards.
And of course, the Premier League, we're going to hear from them later this morning. It's expected they're going to have concerns around their power, not just here, but on the global stage. Do you want to see a weakened Premier League, either at home or abroad?
Of course we don't. I mean, what we need is a thriving, healthy, well-run Premier League. I mean, you've got to remember, 20 years ago, they were paying about 500 million more than the other European leagues in wages. They're now paying 2.2 billion more than the other European leagues. They have just outstripped everybody. The idea they're going to be dumbed down by fair redistribution is frankly nonsensical.
Well, Chair of the English Football League, Rick Parry, thank you for your time this morning. We're going to have more on this later this hour from Culture Secretary Lisa Nandy and also hear from the Premier League before nine.
Yes, indeed. So Lisa Nandy is coming up at 10 to 8. Asked her specifically about those points that Rick Parry mentioned and how this is going to change life for fans. That's coming up in about 20 minutes.
Well, in terms of thinking about that and looking forward to that interview, let's look ahead to a new programme starting this morning with Helen Lewis and Armando Iannucci, who's coming on the programme soon or later.
Strong message here from BBC Radio 4.
A brand new series, Stress Testing to Destruction, the buzzwords and phrases used and abused by politicians.
Pork barrel politics.
Red state.
Purple state.
Sports washing.
Strong and stable.
Flip flopper.
What do they actually mean?
I'm Armando Iannucci.
And I'm Helen Lewis.
And like a couple of disgraced stage magicians recently kicked out of the magic circle, we'll be revealing all the verbal tricks of the trade.
And singling out the worst examples of political doublespeak. Strong Message Here starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
This morning at 9.45.
Yes, speaking to Armando Iannucci at 20 past 8. Weather today, cloudier in the west with a few spots of light rain. Central and eastern areas will be dry with sunny spells.
You're listening to Today. Good to have you with us on Radio 4 with Amol Rajan and Emma Barnett. It's 27 minutes to 8 and now we've got a summary of the news from Chris Aldridge.
The BBC understands that Commonwealth heads of government, mostly from the Caribbean, are preparing to go against the UK at a summit in Samoa and begin discussions about securing reparations for historic slavery. The Bahamas have said the British government will come around in time. Single-use disposable vapes are to be banned from being sold in England from next June. The government say they want to protect health and end a throwaway culture that blights communities. Nearly 5 million of the disposable plastic devices are thrown away each week, often as litter. John Dunn of the UK Vaping Industry Association told this programme the ban could fuel a black market for vapes. The government's spending watchdog says the system supporting children and young people with special educational needs in England requires urgent reform. The National Audit Office says the current system is not delivering better outcomes for children, and despite increased funding for SEN provision, councils are struggling to deal with the costs. Police have arrested a 60-year-old woman on suspicion of manslaughter following the deaths of three people at a care home in Dorset. Officers say the deaths are being treated as unexplained, but that carbon monoxide poisoning is their main line of inquiry. A 2-year investigation has found failings in the way a charity supporting gender-questioning young people was being run, but has rejected claims it was offering medical advice. The Charity Commission, which regulates non-profit organisations, says Mermaids had failed to adapt as it grew quickly with an increasing income. Mermaids says it has strengthened and changed how it operates. Elizabeth Francis, the oldest living person in the United States, has died at the age of 115. She was the third oldest living person in the world. In previous media interviews, her family said that in addition to a lifetime of abstaining from alcohol and cigarettes, her simple lifestyle also likely contributed to her incredible longevity.
Chris, thank you. What a thing to think of. Well, it kind of links, I suppose, in some ways, when we think about longevity and the way we live our lives, to how healthy we are. And there is an obesity public health emergency. The government must focus on prevention and fixing our broken food system rather than relying on weight loss drugs, which is what we've been hearing about in the last week or so. That is the verdict of a new report published today by the House of Lords' Food, Diet and Obesity Committee. It also recommends that food companies must be completely banned from advertising highly calorific or unhealthy food. 2/3 of adults are overweight. Just under 1/3 are living with obesity. And the figures around children make for grim reading too. As Chris Van Tulleken knows, a practicing infectious diseases doctor, a broadcaster and author of Ultra-Processed People, a best-selling book on the matter, and gave evidence to this Lord's Inquiry. Good morning.
Good morning, Emma.
What do you make of the conclusions? I've only read a couple of the headlines out there, but what's your view on what's been said?
This report, which has the sort of great title, Recipe for Health, A Plan to Fix Our Broken Food System, it frames the crisis of diet-related disease with searing clarity. And it lays the blame at the door of the food industry and those in successive governments who failed to regulate the food industry. And I quote from it, the industry has strong incentives to produce and sell highly profitable, unhealthy products. Voluntary efforts to promote healthier food have failed because they do not tackle those incentives. And then it talks about the lobbying influence of the food industry in policy and how the ways in which they may be excluded. So it is, in my opinion, this is a very, very strong, excellent report.
And yet at the same time, we've been having many discussions around the types of weight loss injections that may now be used in a much more widespread way in the NHS, not prevention.
Yeah, I mean, I think of the GLP-1 agonists like Ozempic, semaglutide, as a bit like chemotherapy for lung cancer. We should celebrate them. They will work for some people. They definitely have a role, but they shouldn't distract us from fixing the food environment. We shouldn't allow children. I mean, remember, the crisis, it's almost, we've become so numb to it. 25% of children at the age of 10 are living with diet-related disease. Okay, a quarter of our children. Adults spend a quarter of their life in poor health. Our children are stunted enormously compared to their peers in Eastern and Northern Europe. And that's all
stunted,
driven by
stunted
diet.
Growth. You're talking
stunted
about.
Growth by a couple of inches, by about 10 centimeters by the age of five. So, yes, we definitely need these drugs. Great. But they can't take money or time or focus from fixing our diet. And when we fix our diet, by the way, we also fix all those environmental problems. We reduce carbon. We reduce malnutrition. We improve so many other things about our national life. So
while this report may be bang on from the point of view of you with your expertise and what you know, in many ways, this has been said by various experts over the years now, and we have, as you say, become numb. Some say we've sleptwalked into this. What are your levels of hope like that this new government and that there is going to be an awakening on this front?
Governments, I'm very optimistic about the new government, partly because I think they have a growing population mandate. We have data from, for example, the Food, Farming and Countryside Commission that people support food regulation. The old accusations of the nanny state, you know, everyone's worried about that. I think those are really fading into the background and it's becoming increasingly clear. People feel predated on by this industry. And I have many friends in the food industry. They would like better regulation. They are unable to change as individual companies. They have responsibilities to their owners to generate value. And so behind closed doors, many of them say, we would like this kind of regulation. And nothing in this report is going to reduce anyone's freedom or choice. It's all about improving equality and justice in the food system. So there are some tax proposals for the worst products, but this report is unusual in going, government has been influenced by industry and industry is at the root of the problem, commercial incentives. And all the previous reports have sort of discussed the role of individual responsibility. So I think this is a new report and I deeply hope the government will read it and listen.
So it's those structural things and what the government can do and the financial side of it, which has been, as you say, hotly debated, but perhaps those debates are changing. I thought of you only yesterday having read your book and didn't buy a particular small packet of chocolate because I looked at the label and if it isn't in your kitchen and you don't recognise it, then it's ultra processed. And you didn't say not to eat any of it, but you are in my head. You got in there, Chris. So Chris Vantilikum, there you go. My children won't thank you for that, but in the long term they will. Chris Van Tulleken, thank you.
It is 19 minutes to seven, no, to eight. A good time to talk about leeches, those blood-sucking segmented parasitic worms. And if you're particularly squeamish about blood and you're having your breakfast right now, please take this as a gentle warning, because the thing is, there's good news on leeches. A small population of medicinal leech is now breeding for the first time in London Zoo. And the clue to the good news is in that name, their value to medicine. What is that value? Well, let's speak to Dr. Naomi Ewald, freshwater from the Freshwater Habits Trust, and Omar Ahmed, an NHS consultant, plastic surgeon. Good morning to you both. I should say, sorry, Naomi, it's the Freshwater Habitats Trust, isn't it?
Good morning. Yes, yes, it is. Thank
good,
you.
Good morning to you. And let me start with you, if I could, Naomi. So what do we know about this? So leech numbers have declined for a long time, but you've just had some great success.
Yeah, it's really fantastic news this last couple of weeks. So in the wild, we know that medicinal leech are declining and really are sadly unappreciated in this country as a wild population. So we're doing two things. So part of the work we're doing is to create a network of clean and unpolluted ponds to build out from some important freshwater areas that still have them, but we're obviously concerned that we might lose the populations we have before we've had a chance to recover them. So in 2022 we collected 10 individuals from the wild and partnered with London Zoo, who have just had success at breeding and hatching 40 young individuals, which is really exciting.
Indeed. And Omar, for those who think of leeches as basically appalling parasites, what is their medicinal value, particularly in your world of plastic surgery?
Leeches have been used in ancient medicine for thousands of years. And obviously, as you say, people are often horrified by the thought of leeches, but in modern plastic surgery, particularly in the last 50 or 60 years since microsurgery came into being, they've been incredibly useful. For example, if someone has their finger severed and reattached, or part of their face severed and reattached, like the ear or the nose or the lip, and we can't find any decent veins to take the blood out of the part, what happens is that part of the body becomes congested, becomes all purple and swollen. And the only way to keep that, that tissue alive is to try and drain the blood out. So leeches can be very useful to attach to that body part and drain the blood out long enough for that piece of tissue to survive.
What a lovely image at this time of the morning. I read that this is all about an agent which they secrete, not a secret agent, but an agent secreted called hirudin, which is an anticoagulant.
Yes. Yes, so as you know, the leeches are called Hirudo medicinalis, Hirudo, and so this substance they secrete, hirudin, is an anticoagulant. Luckily for animals that they latch onto, they also secrete a local anesthetic, and they also secrete something called hyaluronidase, which allows the hirudin and the local anesthetic to actually permeate through the tissues rapidly. So what happens is, if you attach a leech to a human being or another animal, you actually don't feel it at all, and they just go away merrily doing their job, hopefully saving that body part. Now, with the advent of microsurgery in the 1970s, what we do is we take pieces of tissue from one part of the body and transfer it to another part of the body, and we have to reconnect the arteries and the veins. So in modern medicine, apart from attaching body parts, when we're transferring body parts and there's a problem with what we call a flap, in other words, the blood outflow isn't good enough, we do all other measures to try and reattach everything and get it working. But if it doesn't work, then these little critters can be a real bonus for us. Yeah.
I'm just trying to imagine being in a room where a leech is brought out. I mean, would you not be awake? Is that the point?
You are awake, actually. It is quite interesting. And many of many medical staff who've never handled or seen a leech before can be a bit squeamish to start with. But normally we explain in detail to the patient what's going to happen. Leeches have been attached to every single part of the body you can think of, and some
that's
we won't
a lovely
mention.
Thought this morning. Taking us to a new place.
This is a questioning why on earth we're doing this, but we're doing it because of this exciting work in conservation. And Naomi, what happens next for your project? Because it is fantastic. If you've got a declining species, to get growing numbers is thrilling. Where do you take this project next, Naomi?
Yeah, so what's going to happen next is, we know that the leeches will take between 2 and 3 years to actually become adults themselves. They're a really long-lived species, actually, and this is one of the problems and obviously why they're declining. And we know that if we create new habitat, they'll make their way there naturally from the existing populations. But in some places, they've been missing for so long that the only way to actually recover that population will be to introduce them. So that's obviously a long-term plan, but hopefully in 5
5 years' time, I'll be able to come back and say we've had success. Just building on what was being said just now, when you walk into a pond where you know they occur, they will actually swim towards you because they're attracted to your movement and your body heat. And it is quite something to see a creature like that, hundreds of them, all heading towards you.
I think we ought to leave it there. But thank you both very much, Dean, and congratulations, Dr. Naomi Ewald and Omar Ahmed. Thank you.
Let's move on. It's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning, interfaith specialist and equalities consultant Julie Siddiqui.
Good morning. Chris Hoy's announcement that his cancer diagnosis is terminal has given me chance to pause and reflect this week. Like so many, I've seen cancer close up. My older sister Tracy died from cancer at an age just a bit older than I am now. My mum has had cancer 3 times and is still bravely living with it. My father-in-law died before he got a chance to see his grandchildren grow up. And my dear friend Marjorie is starting her radiotherapy treatment today. 3 million people in the UK are living with cancer, and a cancer diagnosis happens roughly every 90 seconds. And hearing that the people affected are fit and healthy, have gold medals, or are members of the royal family, is always a stark and poignant reminder that cancer really can reach anyone. I've always felt that Islam has a pragmatic approach and way of thinking about death, and even at the time of burial, the simplicity and speed with which it's done all points to that. The Quran is full of commentary about death, the reminder that we don't have long on this earth, that every soul shall taste death, that we should live in this life as a traveller, passing through and not cling on too tightly to worldly possessions. One verse of the Quran says, "Wealth and children are beautiful decorations of this life. However, good deeds will remain with God, an excellent reward and hope." So it's that constant balance, of course, knowing that death is the one thing that we are all certain of, the thing we all have in common, the thing we need to prepare for but not be scared of, knowing that death may be just around the corner at any time. Whenever someone chooses to share their cancer journey publicly, it raises awareness in so many ways. The importance of being checked regularly, of being aware of our bodies, not ignoring red flags, of not shying away from realities if we think we may have something wrong. And to anyone going through cancer or watching a loved one navigating it, I hope the conversations this week can be of comfort, that you can know that you're not alone and that there is support, help and guidance out there every step of the way. So thank you to Chris Hoy, who has given me, and I think so many others, the reality check we need every now and again, that we must face our own mortality with pragmatism and honesty, but in a way that can be positive and hopeful, despite the inevitable difficult conversations that come with it.
That was Thought for the Day with interfaith specialist and equalities consultant Julie Siddiqui. It's 11 minutes to 8.
Football is one of this country's most lucrative and influential products. It's about to become a lot more regulated too. The Football Governance Bill aims, it says, to empower fans, keep clubs at the heart of their communities, and address the systemic financial challenges that have seen many lower league clubs go bust in recent years. To which critics say, well, if clubs go bust, like any business, there might be a good reason for that. And in the end, the global investment that has seen the Premier League generate record revenues of £6 billion last year cannot be reconciled with a nostalgic desire for elite football to be rooted in local communities. Well, the new bill follows a fan-led review by Dame Tracy Crouch in November 2021, which the Conservatives didn't get round to implementing while in power. A short time ago, I spoke to Lisa Nandy, the Culture Secretary.
For far too long, the experience for too many football fans has been of poor ownership and a lack of financial sustainability throughout football that has put too many clubs at risk. I've had my own experiences of this in Wigan in recent years. Twice we've had to battle to save our club. English football leads the world. It brings joy to millions of people, not just at home, but overseas as well. But we know that football needs change, and that's why we're really pleased that today we're introducing the Football Governance Bill to Parliament that will establish an independent regulator and help the game to thrive.
Weren't the failures of clubs such as Wigan or Bury close to you as well, weren't those kind of failures of leadership and management at particular clubs rather than systemic issues? It's a bit like, you know, if a shop goes bankrupt on the high street, you don't say that the whole of the high street has necessarily got a problem. It might be something to do with that particular institution.
It's absolutely not the case. I mean, the issue at my club, at Wigan Athletic, when we were put into administration, was a case of appalling ownership and an owners and directors test that wasn't fit for purpose. Our ownership was transferred, and overnight, immediately, we were put into administration. It was reported as one of the most outlandish things ever seen in football, in an industry where these things are seen frequently. Talking to fans up and down the country, as I have done extensively since I was appointed to this post back in July, too many fans live with the daily anxiety that their club is only one payday, one dodgy owner away from disaster. We've known for a long time that that has got to change. This goes right back to 2011, when the Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee did an inquiry and concluded that football needed systemic change. Fans have waited far too long for this moment, and I'm really pleased and proud that we've been able to work with them and the football industry to get to this moment.
And how, in practical terms, will this actually empower fans?
Well, I should say there are lots of good owners in football,
yes,
and there are lots of very well-run football clubs, but where there aren't, the bill will enable the independent regulator to take action, to take much tougher measures, including imposing licensing conditions if clubs aren't compliant. On a day-to-day basis, though, too many fans, for example, have seen that there's no effective engagement over issues like club colours. They see their strips being changed without any consultation, stadiums being relocated, ticket prices going up without them being consulted or part of that conversation. The bill doesn't propose that fans have a veto over issues. It proposes that they must be part of the conversation. And there are different ways that different clubs choose to engage their fans. But what this makes clear is that they must do so or face consequences, to put fans right back at the heart of their clubs, because fans are the biggest assets that football clubs have.
And we've been speaking to Rick Parry, who's the chairman of the English Football Leagues, I'm sure you've been speaking to as well. And he's got a particular concern, which is whether or not your party's pushed as hard as he would like on the question of the Premiership giving a fairer distribution of wealth to lower league clubs. Have you pushed hard enough on that? Will you be doing more, do you think?
I saw Rick yesterday, as well as representatives from the Premier League and the Football Supporters Association, to talk them through some of the measures that we're introducing. And I think it's fair to say that they strongly welcomed what we've done. We've strengthened the measures in the bill to deal with some of those concerns, particularly that the last government had decided that the regulator would not be allowed to consider issues of parachute payments in football, which are one of the drivers of wage inflation that has caused real challenges for clubs, not just in the Championship, but in the Premier League as well, increasing significantly the amount of debt and risk that those clubs cover. What we've done is bring that back into the scope of the regulator. None of this overrides the ability of football to make its own decisions. What it does is incentivise football to come to its own conclusion without the regulator needing to step in, but it provides a backstop measure so that if football can't agree, and currently that's where we are, negotiations between the Premier League and the EFL have been going on since March with no conclusion, then the regulator will be able to ask both parties to put forward their own proposals and will be able to choose the one that it believes most improves and enhances the sustainability of the whole game.
Yeah, because the worry is that the Premier League just won't, if you excuse the pun, play ball. I mean, that's Rick Parry's worry. It's the worry of many people, that actually the Premier League will say, you know what, just leave us alone.
Well, in fairness to the Premier League, I think that they have a mirrored concern, which is that the Championship will ask for too much, and the Championship are concerned that the Premier League will give too little. This mechanism, the independent regulator that we're establishing through the bill, is designed to help them come to their own agreement by incentivising them to do so, because if they won't play ball, there will only be one offer on the table from whoever is prepared to engage in the process, and that offer will be selected. So it provides the incentive for both parties to come together, and hopefully, without the need for the regulator to even get involved, we can sort out some of these issues and make sure that right the way through, from the Premier League, which is one of our greatest exports, all the way through the Championship to grassroots football in the centre of our communities, that we can help the whole game to thrive.
Can I ask you finally about a different subject? And I should say up front that I know this isn't the subject you've been thinking about this morning, you've been thinking about football and independent regulation of that sport. But I do want to ask you about what's top of the news this morning, which is this subject of reparations, with the Prime Minister out in Samoa for this Commonwealth Heads of Government Summit. We've been speaking this morning, my colleague Emma Barnett has been speaking to Frederick Mitchell. He's the Foreign Minister of the Bahamas. And he has said many of the institutions in the UK have already conceded the point of apology. This is on the question of slavery. But the British government isn't quite there. And he says to us, "It seems unusual to us because you have the Labour Party in power, and this we thought was something that Labour would certainly change its position on, particularly since you have an Afro-British man as the Foreign Secretary. Do you think that the time has come to consider reparations?"
I think the Prime Minister's been very clear on this. We have heard those concerns loud and clear. And in my former role before the election, leading for the Labour Party in opposition on international development, I had many discussions with many of the people who are currently at the Commonwealth Heads of Government Summit. But the Prime Minister has been clear, and I believe he's right, that we have to focus on the future. There are serious, serious challenges facing countries like the Bahamas. They're dealing with a triple crisis of climate change. They're some of the worst affected countries in the world for climate change, historic debt on very poor terms, and growing problems of poverty. We've got to help them break out of that. And as a country that is home to the City of London, that is the legal jurisdiction where many of those debts are settled, and with one of the biggest insurance markets in the world, we are almost uniquely placed to help them do that.
Final thought. Are reparations wrong in principle?
I'm not going to criticise those who've backed them or supported them, and I'm not going to criticise those who've agreed to pay them. But I think the idea that at this moment in the UK's history, with the challenges facing other countries around the world and the world collectively, that we would be focused on anything other than dealing with the challenges that we have now and how we future-proof the world against climate change would be the wrong approach. And I fully support the Prime Minister on this.
Lisa and Andy, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
It's 2 minutes to eight.
Maths book, pencil case, oh, water bottle, I always forget that. Trainers, calculator, anxiety. I'll bury that at the bottom.
Some children carry more than others, but with our help, their mental health issues can feel lighter. BBC Children in Need. We're there for you.
2 minutes to nine. England have lost two more wickets. They're 102 for five. Here's Sarah Keith Lucas with the weather.
Thanks, Emil. We've got a mostly dry, fine, settled day ahead today. Best of the sunshine towards the east and some brisk southerly winds bringing quite a mild feel to the weather. For the southeast of England, eastern England, the Midlands and northeast England, early mist and fog clears away pretty quickly today, and that'll leave some long spells of sunshine, just a bit more cloud bubbling up through into the afternoon, but temperatures 17 or 18 degrees. A bit further west, so southwest England, Wales, northwest England, as well as all of Scotland and Northern Ireland, away from the Western Isles, is looking mostly dry, a cloudy, a brisk southerly winds, just the chance of a little bit of light rain and drizzle around coasts and hills in the west. Top temperatures here around about 14 to 18 degrees, but for the Western Isles, we're going to see persistent rain for much of the day, and it's going to feel cooler with the breeze and the rain here, with highs only around about 11 or 12 degrees.
Sarah, thanks very much for that. You are with us here on Today, which we're happy about, on Radio 4 with Amol Rajan and Emma Barnett. Good morning, if you're just joining us. It's 8 o'clock on Thursday, the 24th of October. The headlines today. Commonwealth leaders are expected to agree to look at ways of securing reparations for historic slavery, despite the UK saying it won't pay. We'll hear after the news from the Foreign Minister of the Bahamas.
It may take a while for people to come around, but come around they will. Given Sir Keir's work before he became Prime Minister, given Mr. Lammy's position before he got this job that he has now, I think eventually they'll come around to the position.
Yes, you'll be hearing from Frederick Mitchell, the Foreign Minister of the Bahamas, in an interview with me coming up just after the news. Disposable vapes are to be outlawed in England from next summer on health and environmental grounds, and ministers are promising to, as you've also been hearing on the programme today, to restore parents' confidence in the provision of special educational needs.
Coming up before nine, satirist Armando Iannucci, the creator of The Thick of It and Veep, on political buzzwords and nicknames, and...
Well, it's 1341 BC and we're over here in ancient Egypt where a wickle baby has just been born. And his name is Tutankhamun, though he's also known as Tutankhamen, Tutankhamon, Tutankhaten, Amun-Tut, Ankh-Steve and King Tut, though probably not Steve.
A lovely surprise for the team behind Horrible Histories. The BBC News is read this morning by Chris Aldridge.
The BBC has learned that Commonwealth leaders are preparing to defy the UK at their summit in Samoa by agreeing to examine ways of securing reparatory justice for the transatlantic slave trade. That could include payments and an official apology. Yesterday, the Prime Minister said that while there was no question slavery was abhorrent, he wanted the meeting on the Pacific Island to focus on the here and now. Our diplomatic correspondent James Landale has this exclusive report.
Sir Keir Starmer wants the Commonwealth Summit to discuss existing challenges such as economic growth and climate change. But Caribbean leaders want to begin a debate about securing reparations for historic slavery, much of which involved Britain. And it looks like they may get it. I've been told the draft summit communique says the time has come for a meaningful, truthful and respectful conversation about reparatory justice for what it calls the transatlantic trade in enslaved Africans. It also says Commonwealth leaders will agree to prioritise and facilitate further and additional research into the issue. A UK government spokesman said reparations were not on the agenda and would not be paid. The Prime Minister told reporters he did not want endless discussions about reparations. But diplomats said the clock was now ticking on a debate that potentially could one day cost Britain billions of pounds.
Single-use vapes are to be banned in England from next June. The government says eight of the devices are thrown away every second. It's also worried about the impact of vaping on children's health. Here's our political correspondent, Damian Grammaticus.
The government says this ban is about ending a throwaway culture that blights towns and cities and reducing the appeal of vapes to children. Almost 10% of people in the UK, including a quarter of children aged 11 to 15, are thought to use vapes. They throw away nearly 5 million of the disposable plastic devices each week, often as litter. Powered by lithium batteries, which can easily ignite, the vapes can't be refilled and are difficult to recycle. Many end up in landfill or are incinerated. A ban was announced in January by Rishi Sunak when he was Prime Minister, but not enacted before the election. The government says sales in England will be illegal from the 1st of June and is hoping to align that with Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, which are already moving ahead with bans of their own.
John Dunn is the Director General of the UK Vaping Industry Association and told us a ban wouldn't stop people accessing the disposable products.
Research from the Association for Convenience Stores found that 25% of vapers will continue to use disposables despite a ban, because they're still easily available through online sales. But also domestically, we have a black market in vaping products already that the authorities can't really keep up with.
The Metropolitan Police says it will carry out a new investigation into a crash at a school in Wimbledon in South London last year, in which two children died when a car drove into a playground. After the first inquiry, the driver was told there would be no further action. The force now says information which requires further examination has been identified. The public spending watchdog says the system supporting children and young people with special educational needs in England requires urgent reform. The National Audit Office says the current arrangement is financially unsustainable and is letting down families. The government says it's determined to rebuild confidence in the system. Here's our education editor, Branwen Jeffries.
This report describes a system where costs are spiralling without making the lives of children and young people significantly better. The annual budget for special educational needs and disabilities in England has reached £10.7 billion a year, yet councils have spent even more to meet their legal obligations, accumulating large deficits that threaten their financial stability. As growing numbers of parents fear their children won't be supported, many more have applied for legally binding education, health and care plans. This has resulted in a third less being spent on each child with a plan. Although more special schools are due to be built, the shortage of places has also led to an expensive reliance on independent schools. The Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, said it would take time to turn the system around with more early intervention in areas such as speech and language support.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is expected to confirm plans to change the UK's borrowing rules when she meets global finance ministers in Washington later. At the annual meeting of the International Monetary Fund, she'll say her first budget next week will invest in the foundations of future growth. Our economics editor, Faisal Islam, is there.
Rachel Reeves' decision to change the operation of all-important self-imposed limits on UK borrowing has received some support from the IMF. Day-to-day spending in departments on welfare and debt interest will have to be funded by expected tax revenues, not borrowing. This is a tightening of restrictions. But the space to invest in infrastructure and technology will be increased by tens of billions of pounds with a change the way the debt is calculated. The IMF, with its audience of global finance ministers, central bankers, and the banks that buy government bonds, is an opportune place to explain the change as laying the foundations of future growth. Speaking to the BBC, the organisation's Deputy Managing Director, Geeta Gopinath, backed such a move in general.
I just want to emphasise a point that public investment is needed in the UK. If you compare the UK to other G7 countries, investment has fallen short. And so that spending will have to take place alongside having the kind of fiscal rule that stabilises debt over the next 5 years.
Both the Chancellor and the IMF stressed that despite a soft landing for the world from recent inflationary shocks and the need for more investment, debt levels also need to be brought down as risks from wars and trade tensions rise.
Ministers are bringing back to Parliament what they say are strengthened plans to create an independent regulator for elite men's football. They say the draft legislation will tackle rogue owners, improve club finances and put fans at the heart of the game. Here's our sports editor, Dan Rowan.
Initially tabled in March, the Football Governance Bill failed to pass through Parliament before the general election. Today the government will reintroduce it, but with beefed up powers for the independent regulator it will create. It will mean clubs must engage with fans on issues such as changes to ticket prices and improve their record on equality and diversity. The regulator will also have the power to redistribute the tens of millions of pounds that the Premier League gives to relegated clubs to teams lower down the football pyramid. And it will not have to consider government foreign and trade policy when approving club takeovers. The Premier League says it remains concerned that the regulator's unprecedented powers to intervene in the distribution of its revenues could have a negative impact on its competitiveness, investment and aspiration.
Workers at Boeing have rejected a second pay offer from the company on the same day it reported multi-billion dollar losses. More than 30,000 employees have been on strike since the middle of last month. The US Justice Department has apparently warned Elon Musk he may be breaking federal election law by offering a daily $1 million prize to registered voters. The tech billionaire is supporting Donald Trump in the US presidential election. Only voters in the seven states seen as decisive for victory are eligible for the cash. Here's our North America correspondent, David Willis.
Reports here suggest the Justice Department's head of election crimes has sent a warning letter to the Political Action Committee founded by Elon Musk, alerting it to the fact that it is against the law to offer anything of value in order to influence voting in this country. Elon Musk has said he will pick one person every day between now and election day and pay them $1 million in return for signing a petition in support of free speech and gun rights. A key condition of entering the contest, however, is that participants are registered to vote in one of the seven battleground states, and Democrats have argued it's part of a broader effort by Mr. Musk to bolster the Republican vote. Whilst it did not apparently outline plans for immediate legal action, the Justice Department letter did spell out the penalties for breaking US voting laws. which include up to 5 years in prison.
The American actor Ron Ely, best known for playing Tarzan on television in the 1960s, has died at the age of 86. He performed his own stunts in the role and sustained more than 20 serious injuries, among them broken shoulders and lion bites.
Wow. Chris Aldridge, thank you. It's 8:10. It's time for an apology, and it's time to start talking about reparations for the damage caused by the historic transatlantic slave trade. That is the call from mostly Caribbean leaders at the Commonwealth Summit happening right now in Samoa. And the response from Sir Keir Starmer en route to that meeting was very much, it's not happening. It's not on. It's not going on the agenda. A report last year backed by an international court judge, Patrick Robinson, concluded that the UK owed more than £18 trillion in reparations for countries affected by slavery and colonialism. In a moment, we will hear the position from Frederick Mitchell, the Foreign Minister of the Bahamas, one of the 15 CARICOM countries. That's the body that represents Caribbean countries together. But first, Chris Mason, our political editor, who's with the Prime Minister in Samoa, who I've been talking to, and I asked him whether Sir Keir would budge on reparations.
On the fundamentals, Emma, he won't. What might be interesting to see over the next couple of days is where the language goes, because the language from the Prime Minister on the way here was pretty stark. He doesn't want to say sorry, and he doesn't want reparations to be paid. He feels that that would end, or even if you open up the conversation, you end up, as he put it, in a very, very long, endless discussion about reparations on the past. He says he wants to talk about the future. I mean, at the heart of this is a kind of philosophical question about where, if anywhere, guilt can or should lie. You know, can a people, however defined, answer for their forebears, however defined? And the Commonwealth is almost the, depending on your view, the perfect or imperfect crucible for this discussion, because you've got 50-odd countries, 2.7 billion people, members scattered all over the place on every continent, and don't you just know it when you spent 28 hours trying to get to a summit on the other side of the world, and you've got a mix of the rich and poor and big and small in terms of members, and obviously that historical underpinning of countries that were rooted previously in the British Empire, not all of them, but most of them.
How awkward is it for David Lammy, now the Foreign Secretary, who has supported reparations out of office when he is a member of the opposition?
It is awkward. There's just no doubt about that, I think, because when you can so starkly point to verbatim, on-the-record quotes from the now Foreign Secretary a handful of years ago, speaking very passionately about the historical injustices as he saw them of the whole questions around transatlantic slavery and the whole argument about reparations, that he is now the Foreign Secretary in a government that is saying something very, very different and is making the point that the British government's view has not changed. And when they say that, they mean it hasn't changed from the previous Conservative government, that desire to avoid apologising and avoid reparations. And I think the tenor and tone of the language we've heard from the government, not least from the Prime Minister on the way here, I think speaking to folk here has contributed to irritating even more some of those particularly Caribbean Commonwealth countries who might not have necessarily expected the UK or others to suddenly change their view and suddenly start shelling out a lot of money, but perhaps in their view might have found language that was a little warmer or a little more open to the argument that they're hearing from those Caribbean countries and others. So you just wonder in the next few days where that language might go, because as James Landale has been reporting, and you've just heard in the news, there are those paragraphs in this draft communique, the draft conclusions for this summit, that do talk about maintaining that ongoing conversation, meaningful, truthful and respectful conversation about reparatory justice. Now, yes, sometimes these communiques can change during the course of a summit, but the views aren't going to change.
Chris Mason, thank you, and safe travels home from Samoa. Well, let's hear from Frederick Mitchell now, who I've been talking to, who's the Foreign Minister of the Bahamas, and he's shared what Commonwealth nations want to happen next.
I think at the moment, CARICOM countries want the conversation to start about it. There appears to be even a reluctance to have the conversation start. Many of the institutions in the UK have already conceded the point of apology. The British government isn't quite there. But at this time, the discussion needs to be had about the history of this and the ill effects of what happened after slavery was abolished, which continue to affect our societies today.
Downing Street, Sir Keir Starmer's team, they've insisted this subject is not on the agenda at this summit. How are you then going to change that, even starting to have that conversation?
There are two paragraphs which now are the subject of dispute in the draft communique. Just left a session a few minutes ago, and they're paragraphs 22 and 23. The single line that they're arguing about is reparatory justice or a declaration on reparatory justice. Seems innocuous enough to us, because really what should happen is there should be an apology and a commitment to reparations. But the way the paragraphs are structured is, at the moment, is to simply call for this discussion to take place on reparatory justice, and not even that concession can be made. So it's going upstairs at the moment. Unless something happens overnight dramatically, the leaders themselves are going to have to be a part of getting this settled. And it seems unusual to us because you've got the Labour Party in power. And this, we thought, was something that the Conservative Party in the UK would be the progenitor of, and that Labour would certainly change its position on this. And particularly since you have an Afro-British man as the Foreign Secretary, to put him in a position where he's advancing a position that no reparations, no discussion on reparations. So I think a very frank conversation has to be had on this. And I think eventually people will come around, but the discussion must be had.
But I suppose, what are you going to do if you can't? I mean, are you viewing this as disrespectful? You're talking about David Lammy there as the Foreign Secretary. What can you do to force the issue?
First of all, you have to be hopeful that people come around in the end. There's not going to be a big falling out about this issue. But the principle must be established that the conversation needs to be had and some decision has to be made. How do you go forward with dealing with the issue of reparations? So once you broach the subject, it may take a while for people to come around, but come around they will. There are several institutions in your own country, including the Anglican Church, that have shifted their positions dramatically within the last decade or so. So given Sir Keir's work before he became prime minister, given Mr. Lammy's position before he got this job that he has now, they bring their individual consciences to this job. And I think eventually they'll come around to the position.
But just looking at what Sir Keir Starmer has said, he said, you know, he wants to focus on the future. That's where he wants his focus, rather than what will end up being, quote, very, very long, endless discussions about reparations on the past. Of course, slavery is abhorrent to everyone. And he goes on to say, but I think from my point of view, I'd rather roll up my sleeves and work with them, talking of the other countries, on the current future facing challenges, rather than spend a lot of time on the past. That's pretty clear.
So it would seem. But the future is, how do you educate the people of the Caribbean? How do you educate them? Costs money to do so. How do you repair the infrastructure, the social institutions, all of those things? All of those things cost money.
Do you have a figure? If I may, just at this point, do you have a figure in mind?
No, there's no figure in mind. That's why you have to have the discussion, because you have to formulate a basis upon which things are settled.
He seems to have no appetite for this. There's been nothing that's been said by his team, by him directly, by anybody in the room that is going to seem like this has changed.
That's always a starting position. But this is the Commonwealth. They're arguing for change. You have the monarch who says there needs to be a discussion and change. So it's only a matter of time before his position changes. I'm confident of it.
I mean, just in terms of the apology and where we are with that, you know, looking back at what actually, you know, has been said, you know, do you feel you've actually had enough of an official apology? Do you think the King should be apologising at this Commonwealth summit?
Well, I don't want to speak to that specifically. I think an apology is necessary. The British government has to decide who gives that apology. But the British state was involved in the transatlantic slave trade. There needs to be a formal apology from the country, just as other European countries have done.
It was only because I was looking back at what Tony Blair had said in 2006. And And he did say at that time, the bicentenary offers us a chance not to say how profoundly shameful the slave trade was and the condemning, but to also express our deep sorrow that it ever happened. And then again in 2007, he said, "We are sorry, and I say it again now." That was at a news conference. King Charles has expressed great sorrow and regret, but you still don't feel that enough has been said officially.
The word is apologise. That's the word.
If either of those things don't happen, either the discussion of reparations doesn't begin and an apology doesn't happen, neither of which look like they're on the table at the moment, will you feel, and will your colleagues in this way feel, profoundly disrespected by the UK?
I don't want to describe profound disrespect. What I would say is this: it's a disappointment that we've come this far, where there's an argument about the Commonwealth evolving into a new and different organization, that an apology cannot be issued which fundamentally recognizes the wrong that was done in the past and acknowledges the humanity of those people who were affected by the slave trade. It's a simple matter. It can be done, one sentence, one line.
Why do you not think the UK is issuing an apology?
I think because it's been expressed mainly in money terms. And when you start talking about the charges on the exchequer and the expenses which the country now faces, that's a difficult proposition that any politician has to sell to voters. That's why the conversation has to be had, because it's not just a matter of money. It is things like respect. It is acknowledging the past was a wrong which needs to be corrected, and then moving on from there. And some of your own institutions have dealt with, for example, by offering scholarships to Caribbean students. That's one way that's been done, for example, in the United States with Georgetown University, that also was a part of this this nefarious slave trade.
And if you say sorry, you are then liable in that way, with that conversation being linked to the apology.
That's right. Absolutely. I think that's it.
Just to say, on a practical point, I recognise you want to start having the conversation about how this might work. People will have, you know, very strong views and a lot of emotions as well tied up in this. But just in terms of who should pay, I mean, one judge, a United Nations judge, has calculated it could be £18 trillion that the UK owes for historical involvement in slavery across 14 countries. But who should pay in the UK? If you look at the fact that certain figures have it around 15, 16% of British taxpayers are migrants, should they have to pay reparations? There are those from the Windrush generation. There are those who descend from slaves. Do you have a view at this point as to how and who should pay reparations?
Well, I don't think you disaggregate from the British government. It's the British government as an institution. It's the United Kingdom as an institution that was involved in the slave trade. So that's the entity. Now, you know, at one point, CARICOM countries had been speaking to a British law firm with regard to formulating an action in the British courts to have this matter adjudicated. So at the end of the day, perhaps that's where it's headed as well.
Frederick Mitchell there, the foreign minister of the Bahamas, saying what he is, his view and what he's been talking about with other Commonwealth nations of what he wants to happen next at that summit in Samoa where the Prime Minister is.
23 minutes past eight. Political language, wrote George Orwell in his essay Politics and the English Language, is designed to make lies sound truthful and murder respectable and to give an appearance of solidity to pure wind. That quote is reasonably well known, but less well known are the sentences that followed. Orwell said, "One cannot change this all in a moment, but one can at least change one's own habits. And from time to time, one can even, if one jeers loudly enough, send some worn out and useless phrase, some, quote, jackboot, Achilles heel, hotbed, melting pot, acid test, veritable inferno, or other lump of verbal refuse into the dustbin where it belongs." Well, it's to that very task that the great Armando Iannucci, the satirist, writer, director who helped create Alan Partridge, The Thick of It, Veep, On the Hour, The Day Today, has turned, because together with Helen Lewis, he's got a new series out on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. It's called Strong Message Here. And it aims, I think, Armando, to do what? Decode the political doublespeak that dominates our world?
Yes, I'll take that metaphor of a rubbish bin that words should be dumped into. We're kind of doing that. We're looking at phrases that have emerged and are used frequently in politics just now, and how they're used and how they might be misused, and whether politicians use them to avoid saying other things or to imply that they're saying other things.
To avoid saying more intelligent things quite often.
Yes, and Helen will do it much more articulately than me. But
what about nicknames? Aren't nicknames quite useful? I mean, Donald Trump calls Joe Biden Sleepy Joe Biden. He calls the governor of California Gavin Newsom. That's quite smart politics, isn't it?
Well, it was smart for him in that he managed to avoid being asked about his policies as a result of that. I mean, they worked tremendously well. I always think Boris Johnson's greatest achievement, and I personally think possibly his only one, was calling, in the height of the lockdown scandal with Keir Starmer, calling him Sir Beer Korma. But I laughed at that, but I also thought, hang on, that's our job. That's a comedian's job. Why are you spending your time at Question Time coming up with jokes when, in fact, you should be rebutting attacks on your policies?
And
there has been a tendency, I think, for politicians to lead with the phrase first and then try and retroactively find the policy to fit it.
Which gets worse in the age of social media, which is all about things that short-circuit proper thinking and trying to go viral with a pithy phrase.
Yes. So we had, in the last government, stop the boats as a very memorable phrase, but it took them a long time to work out what that meant. In fact, they had to go back to Parliament to change the definition of a word and call Rwanda a safe country. And even then, they didn't quite work out how it was going to work out. And at the moment, we're in the middle of this discussion about what working people means, in that Labour promised not to put taxes up on working people. So who are you putting taxes? So we're going to have to try and define working people. And surely there will be some who do work but don't fall into that category. Otherwise, we're going to only tax people who don't work, which is not, I think, what they got elected to
do.
Which
is not that many people.
Yeah.
Every field of human endeavour has got its own sort of jargon. But why is it that politics attracts so many nonsense phrases? Turbocharged, oven ready.
Turbocharged was the word that made me want to do this podcast, because I can't answer. Nobody uses that word, turbocharged, and it's meant to sound like you're going to pump it full of energy. I looked it up. It's a way of strengthening the power and efficiency of your car by pumping back in old exhaust fumes. So actually, it's unglamorous and actually very nice and involves recycling and is terribly green. But the people who use that word are trying to project this image of some macho, super efficient, powerful force. And in a lot of the leadership campaigns from the last, I know there have been many of them over the last 3 or 4 years, they've announced that as a policy. One of their policies is to turbocharge the economy. Well, what does that mean?
Well, you're going to explain all in this series. Can I very quickly submit two other phrases for your consideration? The first is going forward. What's wrong with in the future?
Yeah, or next. What's wrong with next?
Great, glad you agree. Second one, and I did try unsuccessfully to ban this when I worked in newspapers, but Shakespearean. I mean, Shakespearean is so obscenely imprecise. So
yeah, Shakespearean comedy?
Or tragedy?
I think it's meant to apply to anything that has a whiff of tragedy. So if it's not Shakespearean, it's Greek tragedy.
Right.
And Shakespearean, I think, is much more recognisable to us as a kind of cultural reference.
But it's a way of short-circuiting actual thought. Let me ask you finally about this production you've got going on in the West End in London, Dr. Strangelove. It's Steve Coogan, his four different roles. Opening night next Tuesday. Kirsty Young came on the Today podcast this week, said it was absolutely fantastic.
Oh, good.
What is it about nuclear conflict and the total annihilation of humanity that struck you as rich in satire?
Well, I mean, the film. Kubrick set out to do a serious drama about the Cold War and nuclear annihilation. And then when the more he researched, the more he realized the only way we can tell this story is through absurdity. And we've taken that as our cue, really. It's the film, and indeed the play, is a very slow motion farce involving Steve playing four people.
About nuclear war.
Yeah.
Can't wait. I look forward to seeing it. Strong Message Here begins on Radio 4 at 9:45 on Thursday. It's also available on BBC Sounds. Armando, it's very good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
My submission is I'm thinking in real time. That's what used to be said to me when I covered tech out in Silicon Valley by some people.
In real time?
Yeah, I'm thinking in real time. When do you not?
I was told with something that failed, we'll sunset that idea.
Blue sky thinking all the way, Armando. Thank you. Let's get to the sport where they're doing everything in real time. Sara's here.
Yes, thank you so much. And I could have said this morning that England's cricketers need to be turbocharged, but I will avoid that term now because the series decider between England and Pakistan is not going England's way. away. Despite Ben Stokes winning the toss, that was their first in seven that he'd actually won, and deciding to bat, the wickets have tumbled. At lunch, they're 110 for 5. We're going to go live to Rawalpindi now to talk all things cricket, which incidentally will include patio heaters and cats. Come in former England bowler Alex Hartley. Good morning.
Good morning, good morning.
Right then, 110 for 5, Alex. They were 56 for none. What happened?
Yeah, look, if I'm going to be completely honest, a few weak shots from England. The ball is turning. It's turned more than you necessarily would think that it would on day one. But we know Pakistan have been raking this pitch. They won that previous test match in Multan, so they want to try and copy those conditions. But the ball spun slowly. It's been nothing like if you're playing in India or Mumbai or Chennai, somewhere like that. There's still going to be questions on how England do play spin. There was a weak shot from Zach Crawley, just like poking outside the off stump, Ollie Pope, and then Harry Brooks sweeping. But Ben Duckett did get one that stayed really low, which we call a grubber in cricket, as it would have clattered into the stumps. He was at LBW. So England, having been 5 down, there are some questionable shots in there, and Pakistan have bowled really nicely.
Now, you've said about the pitch being raked. So I mentioned the patio heaters. There were also giant fans that were used by Pakistan to try and dry out this pitch. With the score as it is, how has it affected the match? But also, we have to remember that Pakistan also have to bat on it as well.
Yeah, of course, and I think that's something we need to keep an eye on, is Pakistan will be batting on this surface last as well, because England did win the toss, like you said, but this surface is doing a lot more than it would. Rawalpindi is known for flat surfaces. It's like bowling on glass. It offers the bowlers absolutely nothing, whereas today we've just seen two spinners bowling, as we saw in the last innings of the previous test, and they're getting the ball to move off the surface, and you wouldn't necessarily or normally get that here in Rawalpindi. So they have made this surface... I guess Pakistan have said, you know what, we're going to play our spinners and we need a home advantage, which I respect in some ways.
And the important news of the morning, any sign of the newly named Tuffers the Stray Cat in the TMS commentary box?
No, we left the door open last night and Tuffers has disappeared. We've not seen him this morning.
Okay, well, if anyone does need an update, of course, Test Match Special is live right now on Five Sports Extra. Thank you to Alex this morning. Later today, the government will introduce what it says is strengthened legislation to Parliament to establish an independent football regulator for the elite men's game in England. Intended to improve the club's finances, stability and empower fans, the body will be given new powers, including over controversial parachute payments that are given to relegated Premier League clubs. Now, earlier this morning, we spoke with the chair of the English Football League, Rick Parry, who explained that the intentions of the EFL were not to see the Premier League's power reduced on the domestic or global stage.
Of course we don't. I mean, what we need is a thriving, healthy, well-run Premier League. They have just outstripped everybody. The idea they're going to be dumbed down by fair redistribution is frankly nonsensical.
And we'll be speaking with the Premier League's Chief Policy and Social Impact Officer, Claire Sumner, before 9 o'clock this morning. There's plenty more on the football regulator story on the BBC Sport website, and that is the same place where you can also find the ever-impressive Erling Haaland scoring his acrobatic backheel volley in the air as he inspired Manchester City to victory in the Champions League last night.
Zara, thanks very much. Let's hear from Melvin Bragg ahead of this morning's In Our Time.
Good morning. We'll be talking about Little Women by Louisa May Alcott. She was extraordinarily prolific, writing over 200 works, some drawn from her time as a Union Army nurse in the Civil War, and many lurid horror stories. But Little Women was her extraordinary and enduring success. It's about four March sisters in New England, and it has the rich pattern of a Persian carpet, interweaving many stories as they go along. And with this, Alcott became a pioneer of young women's fiction. That's Little Women, with Erin Forbes, Bridget Bennett and Tom Wright on In Our Time on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds just after 9 o'clock. Now back to today.
Can't wait for that. But yes, back to this programme. A look at the weather. Cloudier in the west today with a few spots of light rain. Central and eastern areas will be dry with sunny spells. So there we go. We can say that for you. But thanks for being with us. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Amal Rajan. It's 26 minutes to nine, which means it's time for a summary of the news with Chris Aldridge.
The BBC has learned that Commonwealth heads of government are preparing to defy the UK at their summit in Samoa by agreeing to examine ways of securing reparatory justice for the transatlantic slave trade. That could include payments and an official apology. Frederick Mitchell, the Foreign Minister of the Bahamas, told this programme, Commonwealth countries want a conversation to start about addressing the past. The government has confirmed the sale of disposable vapes will be banned in England from June next year. Ministers say the move is intended to prevent environmental damage and protect children's health. The Metropolitan Police is to carry out a new investigation into a crash at a school in South London last year in which two children died. The force says an internal review has now identified a number of lines of inquiry that need to be looked at. Ministers are bringing back to Parliament what they say are strengthened plans to create an independent regulator for elite men's football. They say the draft legislation will tackle rogue owners and improve club finances. The Culture Secretary, Lisa Nandy, says it will ensure clubs engage fans in decisions or face consequences.
Chris, thank you very much. Now, throughout the programme today, we've been covering the growing costs attached to special education's needs at provision in England, with a report from the spending watchdog saying despite more money going in, outcomes are getting worse and families are losing confidence. That's the crucial point. A lot of you have been in touch. You've answered our call, so thank you for that. And Hazel's written in to say, I cannot see the Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson's idea of making mainstream schools more inclusive working for many young people with SEND. Many autistic young people cannot manage in school environments, especially secondary, as they're too large, too busy, too noisy, too confusing. More like busy airports with behaviour policies that are inherently discriminatory. My daughter missed almost 3 years of secondary school due to anxiety and her needs not being met. I'm so sorry to hear that. She was badly let down, and this was despite her having an education healthcare plan, which I had fought for years to obtain, including having to apply to the Education Tribunal. That was from Hazel. Thank you. And one here from Sally Ann, who's a speech and language therapist in Devon.
I work across primary and secondary schools, and my caseloads have just grown exponentially. We know that 81% of pupils with social, emotional, mental health difficulties have an underlying speech and language difficulty, and many of these are getting through to secondary school without it ever being picked up before. They are hitting crisis point. Lots of them are unable to attend school anymore because their anxiety is so high. We also know there's a huge percentage of young people with behaviour issues. So young people in youth offending institutions, it's about 60% have speech and language difficulties. By not providing that speech and language therapy support in those earlier years, we are creating a much, much bigger problem in the longer term.
That's Sally Ann who got in touch. And as ever, you can leave a voice note, and it's great to have your voices on the radio. It's important. My next guest, Lucia D'Souza, is one of those parents who has lost faith in the system. She's had to pay for two of her children to be privately assessed for support in this area after her son was wrongly assessed and found himself in a school where he was restrained with a weighted blanket as his so-called therapy and part of it, and was actually lost for 45 minutes on a school trip. Lucia, good morning.
Good morning.
How long, just to start with some of what we're hearing here, how long did it take for your son to get an education, health and care plan?
So there's two elements to this. So I have four children, three of them are autistic. My son was diagnosed at the age of 2.5. So he had what the plan just before that. I can't remember what it was called, but he had that first, and then he had it. So it went straight into an educational healthcare plan, but the plan wasn't right. So we had to go to court to fight to get the plan right for him, because it was totally inadequate for the person that he is. It didn't describe him in any way. And it was just literally, you could tell it was just kind of like a patch job. It was just kind of, oh, I'll just move this over without even looking, assessing him to see where he is now, to kind of, you know, to get it right. And my daughter at the moment, she's going through an educational healthcare plan now. So we've just applied for it. I know it's going to be a fight already before I've even started, already know.
And you've also, I mean, having had now a lot of experience in this, you've also had to pay for things along the way, haven't you?
Yeah, I've paid for my daughter to have autism assessment because the waiting list is 3 years. I've paid for her to have her a sensory impairment assessment as well. For me, as a single mother, it's a lot of money, but I just couldn't wait. I can't wait 3 years for my daughter to get a diagnosis to help her. She's going through her GCSEs at the moment. And so she needs that extra support right now.
And when I mentioned what had happened to your son, was that mm-hmm. as a result? Tell us a bit more about that if you can. Was that though as a result of the assessment being wrong?
Yes and no. So the educational healthcare plan that he had was inadequate. So therefore, the provisions that they had in place for him was wrong. Right. So, for instance, having a weighted blanket for him when he gets heightened, that's not how it works. Jaden self-regulates himself, so he doesn't need a weighted blanket. And especially, you could tell that it wasn't done properly, so they should have weighed him to make sure it was the right size for him, because it wasn't. It was cutting into him. And it made his anxiety so much worse, which then gave challenging behaviour within that college, which then they blamed on him and me for. It's because they didn't do the right assessments, get the right information to get that educational healthcare plan right, it then had a knock-on effect, if you understand what I mean.
Yes. I think it's important to hear that detail.
Yeah.
Lucia, thank you for that, Lucia D'Souza. Let me bring in Gary Orban, a consultant on specialist educational needs and disabilities, is a member of the panel appointed by the government to review the school curriculum in England. Gary, what advice, hearing this, seeing these figures today, would you give to the Education Secretary, a new government?
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for having me on. It's clearly not something that is quick to solve. It's clearly a complex challenge. But actually, and I've got enormous respect for all those families like Lucia, who has to battle with unacceptable waiting times, with having to pay for things out of their own pocket. I mean, enormous sympathy for the battles that are all too common. I think it's worth sort of acknowledging that there are, without devaluing those experiences at all, many children with SEND really thriving in the education system, but actually the way they are succeeding is not sort of valued enough. So actually, if what we value above all else is only whether pupils are age-related expectations or not at the end of year six in reading, writing and maths, actually that often doesn't capture the progress and successes of some of our children with SEND. So not to devalue those really awful, tricky experiences for parents in the slightest, but also to celebrate the wonderful inclusive work of schools at the same time. In terms of the additional money that's being spent, you know, actually it's where you spend that money that's essential, isn't it? So under the previous government's SEND NAP improvement plan and the commitment to needs being met in mainstream, well, that's a sort of, I think that's an ambition that actually many families want. They want their child often to be in their local mainstream school as long as that school can meet needs. So that doesn't come without resource, does it? So mainstream schools have to be supported to be able to meet those increased needs, which is not only about the high needs funding you attach to one child through an EHCP, but actually the training, the time that teachers are given, that every leader and colleague in the school is given and able to be able to sort of be supported to develop their own practice to meet the needs of an increasingly complex cohort.
Gary, that's all we can do for now, but there's a lot more to be said on this and a lot of our listeners getting in touch. Gary Orban, thank you.
It's 17 minutes to nine. Let's go back to the football story this morning. A new independent regulator for football. We spoke to Lisa Nandy, the Secretary of State for Culture, at about 10 to 8. She said this was about empowering fans. Well, Claire Sumner is Chief Policy and Social Impact Officer at the Premier League. Used to work at the BBC. Claire, good morning.
Good morning, Emma.
So are you worried about, there's a proposal to regulate you. Are you worried about over-regulation?
Well, of course, because the track record in this country is kind of two types of regulation. It's either a little bit inadequate, so perhaps water and sewage comes to mind, or potentially it can overregulate. It can be bad regulation, and that can stifle growth and investment. And those aren't my words. Those are the words of the Prime Minister. So we're very positive about some aspects of this bill, but we are concerned about others. So, of course, we support strengthened fan engagement. Of course, we support things like protecting club heritage. And I also think it's really important to tackle bad owners, which I think is some of the issue around financial sustainability. But there are other areas of the bill that we have really serious concerns on and we think should be scrutinised more.
What are those areas?
So I think there are two areas here, and I think it goes to the core of the financial regulation, which is based on banking style, quite rigid regulation, which if it's sort of applied equally to all 116 clubs, could really damage the competitiveness of the Premier League. And it's the competitiveness of the Premier League that's so important, because that's what drives a 20-club competition. Fans get excited because they don't know who's going to win. And I think that's really, really important. And then the other element is something you've been talking about throughout the programme, which is, you know, an unprecedented intervention potentially into the distribution arrangements from the Premier League to the Championship, which are currently in place and actually one of the most generous settlements in football. So there isn't a precipice here. And I think how that backstop potentially works, and I think it should be absolutely a backstop, not a front stop, is going to be critical here as well to confidence in the Premier League.
Yeah, I mean, I put that point about the distribution of the gains from the Premier League to Lisa Nandy. And she said, you know, football is an ecosystem. It's a whole community. And the Premier League has a job to help clubs lower down. I take your point that you say it's perhaps already very generous. Can I ask you about something that David Dean said to us last week? He's obviously
well,
one of the
perhaps I could just expand on that a little bit, because it's really important. I mean, we actually share 1.6 billion of our revenues. That's over a 3-year cycle. In terms of the overall package that we use that money for, it goes to every one of the 72 EFL clubs. It goes to the National League. It goes to the Women's League. It goes to grassroots football. And I'm really proud because I oversee our community investment programme. Now, that's kind of part of what's at stake, because the success of the Premier League generates success everywhere.
And you're
the
saying
EFL is the sixth wealthiest league in Europe. So we've got to get this in perspective.
Our competition's thriving, and so is
the EFL's.
But you're saying that if it's over-regulated, the problem is that the Premier League will make less money and therefore you'll have less money to go around. I hear what you're saying. Can I just put to you something that David Dean, one of the founders of the Premier League, said to us last week, which is, and I know, by the way, you can't discuss the specifics of the legal case that's going on with Manchester City at the moment, because it's a legal case and it's active. But the sort of general impression that David Dean gave us was of a Premier League that's in a bit of a crisis, not financially, but just with clubs that are somewhat at loggerheads or at war. And he said that the Premier League's position as the foremost league in the world is absolutely under threat. Was that fair?
I don't agree with that at all. I mean, actually, where our competition takes place is actually on the pitch. We all enjoyed Bournemouth-Arsenal in terms of the excitement and the fact that, you know, that's where the challenges are. I think that the Premier League has shown over the years that the success that we've actually gathered has been really hard-earned, and I think that that is something that we're worried about being jeopardised by the regulator. I think the regulator is something that potentially could pose a big risk to the success of the Premier League and therefore impact the whole of the football ecosystem. And all we're asking for is that Parliament scrutinises that, thinks about checks and balances, and doesn't actually go to the sort of the Prime Minister's concern of bad regulation stifling growth and over-regulation.
Claire Sumner from the Premier League, thank you very much indeed.
It's 13 minutes to nine.
Well, it was 40 years ago this week that Michael Burke changed journalism and the world with his extraordinary reporting of famine in Ethiopia.
Dawn, and as the sun breaks through the piercing chill of night on the plain outside Koram, it lights up a biblical famine, now in the 20th century. This place, say workers here, is the closest thing to hell on earth.
Well, Michael Burke, Radio 4 giant, of course, with a moral maze, joins us now, as does on the line Christina Lamb, Chief Foreign Correspondent at the Sunday Times. Christina and Michael, good morning to both of you.
Morning.
Good morning.
Thanks, Christina, for joining us. Michael, if I could just start with you. That first sentence, dawn up to the 20th century, we were talking a moment ago outside in the green room, it's very, very spare, very sparse prose. It's often monosyllabic, and I say that as a compliment. Did you write those opening words in such a spare way because the point of TV journalism is that the pictures are the boss?
I suppose I did, but the real truth is that the circumstances in which I wrote the commentary were so very different from what they are normally. Normally in television news, particularly in a competitive situation, you cut the pictures, you scribble the commentary in 10 minutes on the back of an envelope before the satellite feed comes up, and that's it. In this particular case, I'd spent the day with my own thoughts and emotions cutting the pictures, and then got on a plane, an overnight plane from Nairobi back to London, and had 7 hours to think of what to say and how to distill my own experience into that. So I wrote it, then I looked at it and I took all the adjectives out.
Few adjectives, yes, yeah. Exactly.
And then I rewrote it, and then I looked at it and I took out everything that seemed to be requiring people, I was telling people what to feel. And I thought, if they can't work out what to feel with these pictures, then we're all lost. Well, so I took all that out.
There is one word you left in, and obviously this all happened years before the internet, let alone Google. But if you put your name into a Google search bar now, one of the first words that comes up after your name is biblical.
Mm.
Why did you use that word, Michael?
Because when Dawn did come up in Quorum, the people of northern Ethiopia have these kind of cloaks and sticks and so on. They reminded me so vividly of those rather realistic colour plates in Bibles that we 1950s kids had. It just looked like one of those illustrations from my childhood Bible.
Well, the word was perfectly chosen. Christina, you're, as a scribe, without the benefit of TV pictures, someone writing for a newspaper web audience, how is your job different to Michael's, and how is it the same?
Well, I think all of us as foreign correspondents covering things like that, injustice is atrocities, what you hope is to make a difference by what you write or what you report. And very rarely does that happen. This is a really rare occasion. I mean, I was a student when this report came out. I was kind of distracted by other things, as students are, and it was before mobile phones, so we weren't really very aware of the news. And yeah, this cut through, like, everybody was talking about it, and that is so rare. And I think it is, I mean, the pictures were astonishing, those stark images that Mohammed Amin shot. Oh. But also, as you just mentioned, the stark words. And that's something I think often we feel like we're trying to tell people what to feel, as Michael said, because you're so enraged by what you're seeing. But actually, that isn't the way to do it. It is to keep it really stark.
How do you do that, Christina? How do you do that? Do you set out? Is there a difference between you as a journalist who goes to places to report, meet people and find out things, and you as a writer? How do you approach the writing of it to try and, how do you think about that sort of vivid detail, but at the same time not preaching to people?
I think that you are very aware that people are focused on other things, you know, their day-to-day life, their work, and you're trying to somehow find that detail, something, that story that will make them stop and think and it will stay in their memory afterwards. And, you know, sometimes it's frustrating as a writer that you can't do what pictures can do.
Yes.
Sometimes I remember during the refugee crisis, we've written so much about children washing up on the beaches and terrible things, but until that picture of Adam, the boy who washed up dead on the beach in Turkey, came out, that really made a difference. Oh, yeah. And cut through to people in the way that we hadn't been. And so it was a bit frustrating.
I remember putting that on the front page of The Independent and getting a call from someone very senior at the BBC saying, "Are you sure you could do that? Because if you can, then maybe we can as well." Christina, thank you. Michael, final thought to you. Just so much has changed in the world in technology and journalism in the last 40 years. How has foreign reporting changed?
I think it's really, really different. I'm looking at television in particular. You know, I mean, in those days, the 9 o'clock news had an 11 million audience. 6 o'clock news had even more. So it was a shared experience. You knew that everybody in the country would have seen it. We didn't have the 24-hour news cycle, which means reporters spend a lot more of their time on hotel rooftops opinionizing rather than finding out what the story is. There was more of an appetite for seriousness. It was only last week that I think this program decided that the most important thing that had happened in the world was that a drugged up, faded boy band singer had fallen off a balcony. Even the 10 o'clock news, which is normally good on these things, thought it was the second most important thing that had happened in the world. And I think there was a wider agenda or a wider appetite. If you look at the news these days, they seem to be hammering away at the same half dozen stories while whole continents go unmentioned for month after month.
But also, you disappeared for days and no one...
Nobody knew where I was.
What's Burke up to?
The great thing about the BBC is that you get the most enjoyment depending on how much distance you can put between yourself and it, I think.
What a lovely note on which friend. Michael Burke, 40 years on from the reporting that led to Live Aid and Bob Geldof and Mid-Euro, of course. Thank you very much indeed for coming in. And for anyone interested in these subjects, it was discussed on The Moral Maze last night. You can find that on BBC Sounds.
It's 6 minutes to nine, and the children's historical sketch show Horrible Histories will be presented with a BAFTA special award next month in recognition of Horrible History's extraordinary cultural and social impact over 15 years. This series has brought us breaking news flashes like this.
Well, it's 1341 BC, and we're over here in ancient Egypt, where a wickle baby has just been born. And his name is Tutankhamun, though he's also known as Tutankhamen, Tutankhamon, Tutankhaten, Amun-Tut, Ankh, Steve, and King Tut, though probably not Steve. And King Tut's dad was also a king, a pharaoh called Akhenaten. At least, we think that's his dad. It's very hard to be sure, because it was so long ago that no one can really remember. Not even my Nan, and she's really old, though she certainly doesn't look it. Love you, Nan.
That was Lawrence Rickard as a special correspondent, Bob Hale, in the original series. Lawrence joins me now. Most recently, he's been on our screens as one of the stars of Ghosts, alongside other Horrible Histories alumni. And we're also joined by Richard Bradley, executive producer and co-founder of Lion Television. Huge congratulations to you, to the whole team. I thought, Richard, how did it come about, first of all? We just need to go to that, don't we?
It's a slightly random story. It didn't come out of the feverish intensity of a development room. It actually was bedside with my then 10-year-old son, who's now in his late 20s, so you can see how long ago it was. And he said he had a huge pile of Terry Deary's Horrible Histories books stacked up beside his bedside and said, "Dad, you make all these programmes about history for grown-ups. Why don't you try making Horrible Histories for TV?" And I thought, a light bulb moment. I thought, that sounds pretty good. And before you ask, he doesn't get a cut of the production
fee. No? Okay, come on. What a great conversation, though. And we had Terry on a couple of weeks ago, actually, with one of his new books, explaining some of the ways he wrote those books and what he wanted to do with them. Let me say good morning to Lawrence as well. Hello.
Good morning.
Special correspondent, of course.
Absolutely.
What do you think about that influence and that approach in terms of why it connects so well? I was only watching last night with my six-year-old.
I think, I've sort of started to appreciate it in a different way now. I've got a six-year-old, and so suddenly, rather than being from the production side and sort of, you know, I think we were setting out to just make the funniest sketch show that we could, now seeing it, watching it with its target audience and seeing how well it sort of stealthily delivers the educational side as well. And I think it was always that cocktail that really made it work. I think the approach that worked for it was the fact that it went fun, interesting stuff first and context second. And I think up to that point, a lot of history education had been lots and lots of very thick, heavy context. And then every now and then a sort of a fun, interesting fact. And so to turn that on its head is, you know, a great approach for getting children into history.
It also just feels rebellious, Richard, doesn't it?
Totally.
That's the spirit of it.
A sort of anarchic, slightly anti-authoritarian, scatological.
Scatological's key.
Yeah, it really is. Yes, yeah. It's a thread. Public toilets in the Roman world, people having conversations. But I think sort of the anarchic spirit is sort of, we knew in series two when we were in Hampton Court and we were doing, someone had, I think it was you, Larry, had written the lyrics to the King of Bling, which is an Eminem pastiche of Charles II, a pretty, unconventional area of history. No one was looking at the Restoration. We were in Hampton Court and Matt Bainton, we asked the curators if we could get up on the banqueting hall table, and up he went on the table and Brilliant. Did the King of Blame. Yeah. At that point, you thought,
I think no one had ever asked that question before, and so they didn't have a good answer and sort of went, okay, then. And about halfway through, they did go, just so you know, that tapestry is irreplaceable. Which, so, you know, you can have fun, but let's draw a line somewhere, yeah?
Yeah, just don't do anything else. Stay there on the table and watch what you touch. Do you think, just briefly, Richard, very little time left, but was there any pushback from it? I mean, here you are, quite establishment now, getting this BAFTA.
No, I think it's been extraordinary, actually, how this, the response. We've had professors of Viking studies saying it's the best representation of Vikings on telly. We've had university admissions tutors telling us that people have, you know, have put it in their personal statements and, you know, as the reason they got into history. So that's a byproduct. That wasn't what we were intending to do, but it's been amazing.
And favourite character for you, Lawrence?
So many to choose from. I always loved Ben Wilbon's take on Henry VIII. I thought that was great. And I love doing Bob Hale, even though it was far too many words to remember.
Well, huge congratulations. A special BAFTA award for the Horrible Histories crew.
Yes, congratulations, guys. Just time to tell you that if